We are live. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of Fan Friction. Good to see everybody today. Thank you for making it out. If you've never seen the show before, this is a movie debate show where we battle it out over goofy questions. Real movie fans will fight about real movie questions for fake points. It's fantastic. Today we have a very special round with a very special guest, but before I mention him, let me tell you who's here. In Texas, she checks her student's hand. I'm going to start over because you can. It's the internet. In Texas,
live radio.
Yes, good job, Jack. In Texas, she checks her students' homework, but on Fan Friction, she checks our facts. However, today she'll just kick all your asses. Welcome back to the show, Ashley Davis. Welcome, Ash.
Hello, everyone, and yeah, that kind of language would not fly in the classroom. Just saying.
Yeah, you can't show this to your kids, but school's pretty much over, so it doesn't really matter.
Exactly.
He's the only undefeated fan fighter on Fan Friction. That makes him the champ, the Lord of the Belt, and the DVD bunker. Please say hi to Bri. Brian Hurst is here. And everybody else, the camera is on except for Brian, so you're going to have to look in the little tiny box below. That's what we do for the champion. And finally, our special guest. He's the host of Nick Animation Podcast, member of Superhero News, regular on Geek and Sundry's Twitch channel, host of Knocking Dead on Screen Junkies Plus, and co-creator of the Playback channel on YouTube. He's the hardest working man in the geek universe. Please say hello to our special guest, Hector Navarro.
Hi, guys.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Thanks, everybody.
And like I said, for some reason, everyone else's face is going off today, but the person talking, so that's fantastic. All right, so we're going to play 5 rounds of movie debates, and after 5 rounds, the 2 people with the most points will move forward to a lightning round. Well, they will battle it out for a best of 5, so 3 out of 5, to see who is today's Fan Friction champion. And we are going to start right now with round 1, eventually, when Apollo Creed decides that it's time to say ding ding. I will say it for you, Apollo, ding ding. Welcome to round 1. Alright. Kindergarten Cop 2 was released direct to DVD and Netflix last month. In fact, we live tweeted it here. Ashley and I watched it. It was horrible. Please don't ever see that movie. What's the best direct to DVD Netflix sequel is the question. And we are going to start with Ashley.
Alright, so the best direct to DVD or Netflix sequel is from the Hellraiser franchise, the 6th film in the franchise, Hellseeker, which was released direct-to-video in the year 2002. And if you need me to say more, I'll say more.
Yeah, say a little bit about it.
All right, so this is, again, it's the 6th movie in the franchise. It continues with Doug Bradley as the classic horror character known as Pinhead, which is a Cenobite, which is a creature, kind of like if you think about it, like in the Cthulhu mythos, like they're like not quite demons. Some say they're angels. They don't really meddle too much with humans unless they're called upon with a special box called the Lamont configuration. This film also stars Dean Winters as Trevor and Ashley Lawrence making a return as the character from the first 2 films, Kirsty Cotton. And so it's kind of an unreliable narrator tale. Kirsty and Trevor get into a car accident at the beginning of the film, and it's presumed that she's dead. He's a suspect, and through dreams and glimpses, we get an idea of Trevor's character, that he's not a good person. And so we really can't trust his opinions on the situation because of the different horrible things that he's done and what he's done to Kirsty. And it's basically... I'm trying to think of the way to say it. Sorry. It is very... Out of all of the Hellraiser sequels, which there are 9 films in the franchise, this one, even though it's a direct-to-DVD... It's a lot more closely related to the original films because it has Kirsty returning and some other things that I'll say later on in the fight. So.
All right, wonderful. Thank you very much, Hector. You will be second, sir. Who did you pick?
Okay, I picked the direct-to-DVD sequel to the theatrically released Batman: Mask of the Phantasm, which was spun off from the cartoon show Batman: The Animated Series. I'm picking Batman and Mr. Freeze: Sub-Zero, It's a direct-to-DVD follow-up to that, and I think there was plans to at some point release it theatrically, but then they decided to go to the home video market. It is a movie that expands on the origin that was explored in the animated cartoon show with Victor Freeze, his wife Nora. It was a groundbreaking take on the character. There's been no version of Mr. Freeze that's been different from that in movies and in comics and everything. And Batman and Mr. Freeze, Sub-Zero, was better received than the live-action Batman and Robin that came out the same year that featured Mr. Freeze and Poison Ivy. I mean, Roger Ebert said that it was better. People had it at a 90% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes is what it's at, 90%, which is the highest Batman direct-to-video cartoon until Batman Under the Red Hood took over with 100% approval rating. But that's not a spin-off of like a theatrical anything. So it was a great, great movie. It had the same style, the same vibe as the cartoon show and Mask of the Phantasm. It was for children, but it was for adults at the same time. It was that classic high quality animated stuff. It was sad as well, because it like I said, it explored the ongoing story of Victor Freeze, and he was a very sympathetic villain, and it had Batgirl, and it had Robin, and it had Batman, and it was awesome. So Batman and Mr. Freeze, Sub-Zero.
Very nice. All right. And Brian, what did you pick?
My pick is a fairly recent release. I believe it came out earlier this year, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sword of Destiny. So, well, the first thing I think that I want to just get kind of out there is that this is a groundbreaking moment in film in and of itself in the way this movie was released, not only simultaneously to Netflix, but theatrically as well. I think just in a historical sense, it marks a groundbreaking moment in the way we are, like, kind of having media delivered to us and kind of marking a new peak in what digital content and streaming content can bring. And I feel like we could be opening a door to where more, especially foreign content that doesn't get big American releases, can get seen by American audiences. And I think this is a great way to kind of get that started. Secondly, when we're just talking about what a great sequel needs, coming back, returning Michelle Yeoh as the star, you know, an amazing actress, amazing action star in her own right. Now, I'm not going to spoil Crouching Tiger if you haven't seen it. That's a great film. But for reasons that are germane to the plot, Chow Yun-Fat does not come back for the sequel. But he's replaced with possibly the biggest star you could possibly get for your movie, and that's Donnie Yen. Donnie Yen is from the Ip Man trilogy, from countless big-budget Chinese blockbusters. I mean, he's literally the Chinese action star. He's going to be in Rogue One this year. I'm hoping it's yet. I mean, he's had a couple chances for American audiences to pick up on him. I'm really hoping this is going to be a breakout, so we'll get to see him in some more things. But to get him in your straight to Netflix movie, to me, is like unreal as a fan. A lot of people who loved Crouching Tiger kind of loved the action, but thought the plot dragged a little bit. I believe they shore that up in this sequel. There's more action in it, but they don't do it at the expense of some of the complex character relationships and the things that make that action have meaning. I think that was a great part of the original Crouching Tiger, that those fights are like a conversation. There's things that are being said during those battles that aren't being verbalized, but that same element is in this sequel too. All
right, guys, fight.
Since I was the last to go, can I just say a couple things about your guys's? I mean, since I had to wait my turn so patiently. Hector, you are not going to trick me into saying anything bad about Batman the Animated Series or Bruce Timm's work on the internet. That is such a smart play, I'm not going to lie. I will say that the animation doesn't quite live up to Mask of the Phantasm level. It's still
less of a budget.
But that Mask, I'm just saying, we're putting it on the table. It's also not the best Mr. Freeze story from that show. I believe the Heart of Ice, his origin story is, and then even Cold Comfort from season 4, where he is just flat out destroying people's hard work. He's not trying to steal or anything. It's just the ultimate bottoming out of Mr. Freeze. I feel like those are slightly better stories to be told.
Absolutely. They're slightly better. But when you compare direct-to-video sequels, it's still the highest quality of all of the direct-to-video sequels.
Fair enough. What about those polar bears, though?
Yeah, they're fantastic.
What about those polar bear henchmen?
If Harley Quinn's allowed to have hyenas, Mr. Freeze is allowed to have polar bears and care for them. It had an environmental message, which is fantastic. We didn't have that since Captain Planet and the Planeteer, so I think that's great.
And the racist Eskimo kid, I'm going to say it, that Eskimo kid's that's a racist portrayal.
Whoa, his Inuit sidekick? It was fine. It's okay.
Justify that? You're going to get off your board with that?
Because there were Mr. Freeze and the Batman characters, they're all pulled from DC Comics, and there is way worse racist portrayals in classic DC Comics, like Green Lantern's sidekick, whose nickname was Pie Face because he liked moon pies, who was an Inuit or Eskimo character. And they didn't go with that. They gave him a legit Inuit name, and he was, you know, up north and all of that stuff. So not the best, but not the worst by far. Not the worst. Could have been much worse.
The Batman movie, to me, it just like watching it last night, it just felt like it was a very, very long episode of the animated series, animation quality wise. Plus, they even scheduled in pauses for commercial breaks, obviously, you know, to air it on television. The CGI moments with like the submarine, and there was like a few other bits where it's like, oh gosh, that stands out so bad, that does not hold up very well, and just the animation quality, like Brian said, again, it just felt like the animated series, and it felt like a lot of plot points were kind of dragged out to be like, okay, well, we need to fill in our theatrical time code, what can we have them do now, okay, well, let's have Dick and Barbara, like, talk about going to the drive in the country. Let's have this awkward phone conversation. And just all sorts of little things that, again, it's like we need to drag this out so it can get that theatrical time code.
I see what you guys are. You guys are ganging up on the new guy. That's what's happening. Okay, that's fine.
You almost won TV fight, sir. New, I would not describe you.
And then to Brian's film, the sequel to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I felt that, like, the plot, like, I know it's based off the novel, but it just felt very generic, and it didn't feel like it had that something special that Ang Lee brought to the original. A lot of the fights were really cool because the film itself was directed by the fight choreographer from the first one, but I don't know. I felt like something was lost, and I didn't know if it was maybe because instead of filming it in Mandarin and then dubbing it into English, they filmed this one in English first because people complained about the first one, like people's Mandarin accents were wrong. I don't know. It didn't feel like as magical as that first one. And with the whole releasing it simultaneously in theaters and on Netflix, like that really hurt the film domestically. A lot of the theaters in our market were like, well, you can't do that. We're not going to show that movie in our theaters because we're not going to compete with something like Netflix. That's going to sully like our reputations. We're not going to have that. So it's only theatrically released, very limited in the United States and then also in Hong Kong.
But I think that's why the producers did that in the first place. They probably ran the numbers on what they thought they could make theatrically based on the release. Because although the original was a super popular and it was culturally significant and it was awarded by critics, it still, I mean, it made money, but it didn't break the box office, and it's been a long time and sometimes a big gap between a sequel. And I think they understood that. And that's why I think they knew it would be big overseas, but they would probably make a better profit by partnering up with Netflix and letting it reach a wider audience. And I agree that I think that, you know, obviously Ang Lee is a brilliant filmmaker and Yen Wu Ping is a great action choreographer. And maybe doesn't have exactly the visual style that Ang Lee has, but I think that he brought the spirit from the first film. He made up for his shortcomings by increasing what he did best, which was really focus on the action. And he brought in an amazing villain who I forgot to mention, Jason Scott Lee from Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, who's like an underrated action guy who really, and he is terrifying and monstrous in this movie. Like, he looks huge. He looks like a professional in this, but yet the fight choreography and his movement and everything, he keeps up with Donnie Yen, who, like I said, is probably like the top five martial artists in film of all time. So, can I now talk about Hellseeker just a touch? Can I take just a taste of Hellseeker?
Yeah, and let's kind of wrap up with final thoughts as well. But how is yours better than these other two movies, Brian?
Okay, well, let me just touch on Hellseeker. I know that one of the big things that people like about that is that they brought back Ashley Lawrence, but to me that is like a desperation move. When you have a fair movie and you want fans of the original series to take a look at it, you're like, hey, look, we got series favorite Christy Cotton's back, and then you drag her character through the mud and damage it as far as I'm concerned, because instead of tricking Pinhead and being smarter, she's committing murders herself in this one. Sorry, spoiler alert for people who are going to watch Hellseeker. But I just feel like that is not my Christy Cotton as far as, like, I like it better when she was... Now, I will say that Doug Bradley, Dean Winters, they're great. Dean Winters is awesome in everything. I'm not going to take anything away from that guy. And having original Doug Bradley definitely puts this one above the sequels that don't even have the real Pinhead in it. But just being better than terrible sequels does not make you the best of all time.
Hector, give me your final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Listen, guys, you guys tore me up in that one. Well done. And it comes down to that all of this is subjective. All of it is just judging a movie for what is the best of these movies, and these are three entirely different movies, and it's so tough to do that subjectively, but I have some actual numbers and facts. Here's what I got, okay? I mentioned that Batman and Mr. Freeze Sub-Zero had a 90% on Rotten Tomatoes. Just going off of that, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sword of Destiny is a lesser sequel. Even though it was groundbreaking and released in China and then on Netflix, it's lesser. It's got a 15% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's got a 4.9 out of 10 on Metacritic. It has a mixed or average reviews and an IMDb score of 6.2 out of 10. Hellraiser had a score of 5.1 out of 10 on IMDb. Hellraiser, Hellseeker, the other thing about that one is I was at least aware of the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon film. I'm not a huge horror guy, but I didn't even know that this was a Hellraiser movie. I had to look it up. It was so obscure, at least a little bit outside of the horror genre. And again, Sub-Zero had a 7.2 out of 10 on IMDb overall. That beats 5.1. That beats 6.2. People know that Crouching Tiger and the Hellraiser sequel, even though they did interesting things for their sequels, they're lesser films than the original, but Batman and Mr. Freeze Sub-Zero was a step up from even a live-action Batman entry that came out that year, and it continued that high quality of the
anime. That's a real low bar you're setting there, friend. That's a very low bar.
Ashley, how about your final thoughts?
All right, so Hector, you admitted that we kind of like tore down your film, which, you know, smart pick, picking something from DC Animated, but it's not as good as Batman, The Mask of the Phantasm, and it's like the animated series, you know, but like longer. And then Crouching Tiger, again, that's, you know, like it's just not as good as that, the classic movie. Some, you know, people are going to knock Hellraiser, Hellseeker because, you know, maybe not a lot of people outside of the fandom have heard of it. But, you know, who's heard of it? Clive Barker himself. This was the last one that he had any involvement with unofficially because him and Dimension Studios were having issues because of Inferno, the previous direct-to-video sequel. And when he found out about it, he actually gave them some pointers on the film to help out with the third act. And he actually said this, like, he's like, thank God somebody finally got it right, saying positive things about this sequel. The effects guy, Gary Tunnicliffe, he basically took a pay cut, almost didn't make any money doing the makeup for Pinhead because he really believed in that character and the property. He wanted to do it right instead of, you know, making it look like a cheap knockoff of Pinhead like it does in some of the other sequels. So again, you know, maybe it's not the most well-known movie, but the creator of Hellraiser himself, Clive Barker, gave it his stamp of approval, and that's good enough for me.
All right. I don't have a giant hammer, but ding, ding, good job. That's the end of the round. Let's go to Tom and Kimber for some fact-checking here. What could we have on the fact-checker chair today?
Everything was pretty legit. I'm seeing that Hector got his 15% from Rotten Tomatoes on Wikipedia, I have some good news for Brian. It has gone up on Rotten Tomatoes' actual site. It's now at 18%.
Yeah, that's right.
And as far as Hellseeker,
DVD Bunker does not support aggregate scoring, by the way.
As far as Hellseeker is going, it is considered amongst fans the best of the sequels. Other than that, everything was pretty clean. I know Kimber saw some
Yeah, so Hamza Juicer out on Twitter has a final exam tomorrow, but made time to watch this, so shout out to them. As well as our very own Sam Catlin, which is up, who's up at 4 in the morning in Melbourne. You also had some shout outs for other suggestions. Most of them seem to be Disney-like sequels straight to video, Lion King 1.5 and Aladdin Return of Jafar. And whenever you're ready, I have the results of the polls as well.
Fantastic. And if you are following along at home and want to tweet at us, it is This Is Tough. That's T-U-F-F. Kimber's watching the Twitter feed throughout the fight today, and she'd be happy to read some of your tweets, especially if they're good. So please tweet along with us and enjoy the fight. This is a tough fight. This is a really good fight, in fact, too. But Hector, I don't think you're going to disagree that they came after you pretty hard this round.
Well, welcome
to the show. Thanks for doing this. I think for me, like, you know, you do have the target on your back, and I think that they really took a lot of shots at you on this. It's not the best Mr. Freeze storyline. It's almost like a longer episode of the show, but without all the same quality. It also kind of does have the advantage of course, it's going to be watched. It's the, it's DC Universe versus the other two, which are a little bit more obscure. So for me, I was drawn a little bit more to Ashley and Brian's fight. Brian, the thing that really stuck out for me about yours was, like you said, bridging the gap between theatrical release and Netflix. I thought that was a really interesting thing. I didn't actually realize that there was also a simultaneous release, so I found it interesting. And I really like how fans apparently thought that the Hellraiser one, Ash, was the best of all the sequels, direct to. Brian made an argument against you that said, you know, yeah, it brought back the people, but it's not, you know, it's not my favorite version of the people, but it brought back the same people. And yet that's also Brian's argument, technically, for the fact that his cast is returning. We're adding Donnie Yen, but honestly, Ash, no one really took you seriously during that round, and I think you had some great points about Clive Barker and the pay cuts people took to make this work. And I gotta say, my fact checker, I think, helped me put me over the edge with that last comment that people think it's the best one in the series. I'm picking Ash for round number one.
Yay!
So Hellraiser improbably wins round one. Congratulations.
I will take that. I did not think I was gonna win. Oh my
god. Very
gosh.
Nicely done.
Good.
Did you want to hear those polls?
Yeah, what's the poll, Kimber?
They disagree with you on Twitter. We got Batman Sub-Zero at a solid 60%, Hellraiser following at 30%, and then Crouching Tiger 2 at 10%.
Also,
fun fact.
That's okay. You know, I got to take those obscure picks sometimes.
What were you going to say, Hector? I'm sorry. Or who said fun fact? Someone said fun fact.
Me did. I did. The blood type that Noah Freeze has in Sub-Zero is AB negative, which is actually compatible with most blood types. So
nice.
He didn't do his research too well. Freeze, not Hector.
Yeah, so Hector, if anybody thinks we're going to be playing favorites with you today, clearly round one is an indication that you're in trouble. However, when you win rounds 2 through 5, we'll understand rather quickly that I'm
better win the superhero theme brown or I am an idiot. That's my whole thing. So, speaking
of that round, let's go to round two, the superhero movie round. Ding, ding. X-Men Apocalypse was just released in theaters, and it's kind of getting a lukewarm reception amongst fans and critics. So what we wanted to do was kind of have a little fun with this round, and we said, if you were Apocalypse, who would you have chosen as your four horsemen? Now, there was a stipulation I gave them, and that is simply that I don't want you to choose anyone from the MCU. We get enough talk about the MCU with all the movies that are out. Civil War just came out. So what we try to do is stick to all of the other properties that the MCU does not use right now. And for this round, we are going to start with Hector. Who'd you pick?
Okay, I can start? All right, here's who I picked. This is a tough one because, you know, you can draw a lot from comic book stuff, but you also, in my opinion, have to make it fit with the other existing X-Men films. And we all know that their timelines are all screwed up. They're all over the place. What would have been maybe better choices for mutants as opposed to Magneto, Storm, Angel, and Psylocke that they went with in the movie X-Men Apocalypse? So here's what I went with. Going off of that, knowing that the last time we saw this fan-favorite character was in X-Men Origins Wolverine, which is a movie that was a prequel that took place back before Wolverine joined the X-Men in the first film in 2000. It showed the origin of how Wolverine got his metal skeleton, and we were also introduced to a character named Gambit, played by Taylor Kitsch. So this is happening around the 80s, so I'm going, let's go with Gambit, now this time played by Channing Tatum, which is what Fox wanted to do, to then set up his own spin-off movie. Now, if you're saying, but the Gambit movie should take place in present day, like Deadpool or whatever, the timelines are screwed up. This could have been something that could have been closely tied a little bit to, yes, we know that X-Men Origins Wolverine was a terrible movie, but the stuff that happened in those movies, we're still going to stick true, just like the Star Wars prequels. That's what they do. So my first pick is Gambit. We all wanted to see what Channing Tatum is going to do with the character. My second pick is one of my most favorite characters in the movie X-Men Apocalypse, so I'm surprised they didn't do more with. I thought he had a great performance with the actor. I thought that he was a really interesting looking character. Caliban. Caliban, who was, he had the mutant power to detect other mutants, and he had a very interesting scene. He was really cool. He spoke in the third person. He goes, Caliban always knows this and that and this and that. I thought he was really cool. So he's a character who has not been explored in movies yet. He hasn't really been explored that much in the comic book, so that's my second pick. Third pick. Well, why did they pick Olivia Munn's Psylocke? Well, because Olivia Munn looks great as Psylocke, and also because you need diversity. You need to have people that are not just the straightforward sort of white characters that usually populate a lot of these types of movies. And that's why they went with Olivia Munn. That's why they went with Storm. But in my version, I wouldn't pick Psylocke because to me that character is not that sort of Omega-level mutant character that Apocalypse would be drawn to. She's just kind of a fan favorite that they sort of stuck her in there. My third pick is going to go Sunfire, who is the prominent Japanese male mutant from Japan who has awesome powers, and so far three of these characters that I picked were also Apocalypse's horsemen in the comic books at one point. So it's so far totally comic book accurate, and with my fourth pick, still going comic book accurate, here's my wild card. I'm picking a female character, because so far I got three dudes. I'm picking a character who would have an awesome power display. She would look really cool. She would be similar to how they kind of used Angel, but then they didn't really use him all the way. And I'm going to go with Deathbird. Deathbird is a member of the Shi'ar alien race. Now, here's the other thing about X-Men. People love the X-Men movies, but so far the X-Men films haven't gone full sci-fi with it. A lot of people love Chris Claremont's contribution to the X-Men mythos in the comic books, and where he took those characters, they all went off into space, they explored the Dark Phoenix saga, and they described how that was actually a cosmic alien entity as opposed to just Jean Grey being very powerful at her mutant abilities. So I'm going, let's bring in Deathbird to set up for the future X-Men sequel. That's probably not going to be directed by Bryan Singer, but it's going to take place in the 90s with their new cast of characters, because I'm going off of the rest of the movie's going to remain the same. And you introduced a young Cyclops, a young Jean Grey, a young Nightcrawler, you know, Jubilee, all this and that. But with the Jean Grey element, you can plant that seed of, let's this time around, instead of doing the Dark Phoenix saga by Brett Ratner in X-Men The Last Stand, do it more closely to the comic books, and just go for it. Just go for it. We're now used to, as movie audiences, used to bringing in those insane themes. Next year, we're going to see a Hulk movie, rather a Thor movie that just has Hulk in it. And we're going to get explained, yeah, Mark Ruffalo's Hulk was just kidnapped from Earth by aliens, played by Jeff Goldblum, and put on another planet. Now he's going to fight Thor. And where we came from in movies just a few years ago in 2008 with that first Incredible Hulk movie with Edward Norton, we're at that point as movie audiences where we're like, we totally would accept that. We're totally ready for the crazy science fiction element of these characters. Not everything has to be so grounded and dark and gritty and realistic. So bring in some of that crazy sci-fi adventures that the X-Men go on, and you do that by planting the seed of having Deathbird, who was a sort of evil side character of the Shi'ar Empire, this sort of bird-like woman with cool powers. And then at the end of the film, she's going to escape or signal her, you know, there's going to be a post-credit scene that teases that. And then in the next film, Charles Xavier is going to meet Lilandra, Empress Lilandra of the Shi'ar. So go for that. All my characters are comic book accurate. They are planting seeds for other movies, including Gambit and Deathbird. They are super cool and diverse, because I got my Sunfire in there, who's a great character. He was even one of the original members of Big Hero 6, the Disney movie that was the comic book that the Disney movie is based off of. And then I got Caliban, just because I liked what he already did in the X-Men Apocalypse movie. So I think those four picks would be better than what they went with. That's what I'm going with.
Oh, all right. Thank you, sir. That's a lot of information. Good luck, guys.
It all
checked out. Let's go to Brian next. Brian, who'd you pick?
All right, so you know, I was basing my picks. I kind of stayed. I'm not too worried about the movies the way they stand right now, because, like you said, everything's mixed up. So I just went ahead with some people I wanted to see. And one of the problems I had with X-Men Apocalypse was not just the way that Apocalypse chose his mutants, but the mutants that he chose. Like, if Apocalypse was really looking to do worldwide damage, why did he only pick two Class 4 or Class 5 mutants and then a couple of chumps, basically? You know? So my picks are all about maximum damage. The one exception being my first pick here, who's really just because every group needs a wild killing machine, and that would be Dokken, the son of Wolverine. And basically I picked him because he's got all the same advantages of Wolverine, except he doesn't have that moral compass. He's more evil, he's more morally corrupt, he's easier for Apocalypse to use and make part of his group. He just fits better. You don't have to worry about that turning back. Now, I like that Sunfire pick. I didn't pick him for the diversity reason. I'm not as progressive as Hector, but I did pick Sunfire just on flat-out damage alone. You're talking about scorched earth, nothing destroyed like fire, and that is exactly the reason that Apocalypse would choose him. My third pick, I also wanted to get a female on my team. I picked Polaris. We saw how powerful the power of magnetism was in Age of Apocalypse. I figured she's got a lot of power, but she's less unpredictable than Magneto. She'd be easier to control for Apocalypse. She's got less of, you know, less free will, less spirit. And then my last pick, my heavy hitter, was Mikhail Rasputin, the older brother of Colossus and Magic from the X-Men. We all know that Marvel loves to make older brothers who are super, super powerful because they end up being villains to fight with our X-Men. He has matter manipulation on the subatomic level, so that's just basically, you know, anything he wants to do there. Oh, and on top of that, portal creation, space and dimensional, interspatial and interdimensional travel. And the upper limits of his powers haven't really been very well defined. Now, you know, he's an obscure name, but like we've seen, they find ways to get these characters in. Being a brother of a pre-existing X-Man is a pretty good door to get a name like that in there. So I think this is the most destructive team. This is the team Apocalypse would put together if he was really serious about laying waste to the Earth.
All right. Ashley.
All right.
You're not the comic person in the group, so I wish you good luck on this one.
Yes, I have a lot of work cut out ahead of me, whatever that phrase is supposed to be. So if I were Apocalypse, I would pick people that have not failed me in the past. And so I was trying to think who, and I had to look up, how close are the horsemen to the biblical ones? Because that's what I know the horsemen from as a, you know, teacher of literature. You know, we have to know these things. So that's how I cast mine, was like, what role would they fill on the team? Or as my kids might say, the squad, you know, because we got to be cool, but not really. I can't believe I just said that. Anyway, so coming in at death, I chose Deadpool. We know his, you know, he has the regenerative healing factor from the Deadpool movie that was really successful. He can do a lot of things. He breaks the fourth wall. And the thing I thought was really cool in the movie, it's like, look at what he could do with 12 bullets because he forgot his stuff. What could he do imbued with Apocalypse's power, like where basically he could have the God code on all the time and, oh, no, I forgot my bag of guns and bullets. Oh, well, look, I have hammer space right here. Here's all my stuff. I don't even have to go find that cabbie. And then the next archetype I was trying to fill was Famine, and so I chose Iceman, who has been in the X-Men films before. Most recently, he was in Days of Future Past, kind of in a smaller role. And I thought, you know, with his powers of, like, controlling and manipulating ice, like, he would be able to do a lot of damage to the surrounding area and to other people. And then for filling the role of Pestilence, I chose the Omega-level mutant Elixir, who can control the biological structure of any organic matter and can manipulate people that way. So I thought that was really close to that archetype. And then for War, I chose Colossus, who is also in the Deadpool movie, the brother of Brian's character, who has the organic steel and is a very strong character. And I think that, you know, given the right circumstances, any of these characters could be easily manipulated to join with Apocalypse, or in Deadpool's case, you know, he's a mercenary, you know, for the right price, right circumstances, you know, he could ally himself with anyone. And I picked all this before I did some research just on the characters I knew. And apparently in X-Men, Extraordinary X-Men number 8, it's revealed that both Deadpool and Colossus are now new horsemen of Apocalypse. So I thought that was kind of weird that I chose something and it ended up accidentally coming true. So that happens a lot to me.
Very
but
nice.
Again, the reason I chose them, I was trying to go with, okay, who hasn't been on the team yet? Because if I were Apocalypse, I'm not gonna go with the people that have failed me in the past. I'm gonna go with the people that I think could help me in the future. And as this comic run is still going, Deadpool and Colossus have not failed, him yet, so.
Very nice. Three great perspectives. Let's get a little brief, discussion here about who's better. Who picked the better team?
I'm going to take the lead on this one. Jack, if you don't mind, because you guys all made excellent points. You had some really cool picks. I really, really like a lot of these characters. But talking about how the X-Men movie timeline themselves, they don't really care. They're not concerned with any sort of continuity. And that's true. They're not. But I also think this is an important point to make, that it's very easy to fit stuff into continuity. It's easy to do it. So why even ignore that? Why not attempt it? And I feel like, Ashley, with your picks, Deadpool's fantastic, Iceman's fantastic, Colossus is fantastic. If they were in the movie X-Men Apocalypse that took place in 1983, it would screw up with a lot of the previous timeline that the X-Men films set up. Iceman and Colossus are modern characters that are supposed to be young right now. And then Deadpool is another character who has a movie that is supposed to be taking place in the year that it came out, which was earlier this year. And the other thing about Deadpool, too, Elixir's fine, that's fine. But the thing about Deadpool is that he's a character that you have to treat very, very carefully to not overexpose, because then people will get sick of him. He's a fantastic trick, and that trick of breaking the fourth wall and being as Deadpool as you can be right there, you can't overdo it, but then like Wolverine in the 90s, people will get sick of him, or like Batman all the time, and won't still appreciate what's special about him. As far as Brian's picks, he had some fantastic choices. Here's my problem, especially like your pick of Sunfire, great choice. Here's my problem with Dakin, Polaris, and Mikhail Rasputin. All three of those characters, are relatives of other characters, and you would have to explain. You would have to explain, unless you don't want to, which is fine. That's your call. You'd have to explain how Mikhail Rasputin is the older brother of Colossus, and there'd have to be some sort of way that the X-Men movie explained, well, Colossus is going to be born later, or he was just born, and he's a kid. And those movies' strengths are not familial relationship. We saw X-Men Apocalypse, and Havoc, who's supposed to be 40 years old, but he looks 20, introduces his 16-year-old kid brother, Cyclops, and that whole thing's mixed up, along with Polaris, who is the daughter of Magneto. Now, in that movie, if you're going to have Magneto still lose his other family, then it's like, where's Polaris coming from? Is Apocalypse kidnapping that younger girl? What age is she going to be? How is the sort of movie going to be different? Polaris is a whole nother thing that the last X-Men movie barely touched on Magneto having a kid in Quicksilver, maybe having a daughter in Quicksilver's sister Wanda, who we even didn't even catch a glimpse of in this movie. And in this movie, we didn't even get the payoff of Quicksilver saying to Magneto, you're my dad, because he said, oh, I'll save it for this movie. So it's really, really frustrating how the X-Men films handle those familial relationships. On top of Dakin, if you're going to have Dakin, you might as well pick Wolverine, because at least it's Hugh Jackman, he's got the star power to be that character, one of the Horsemen of Apocalypse. If you're going with Dakin, I want that character explored in an entire Wolverine movie. He's a character who deserves the character of Logan dealing with and confronting with the fact that he had this kid that he wasn't aware of, and he didn't have that moral code, and that's a whole separate thing. The Horsemen of the Apocalypse really should just be sort of side characters that are setting up the main villain of Apocalypse, then being more interesting than Apocalypse himself. If you show me Dakin, who's like a half-Japanese, half-Canadian, you know, guy with claws, but they're kind of different, and he's got tattoos, and he doesn't have that moral code, I'm going to be like, I want to watch the movie with this guy the entire time. I don't care about Oscar Isaac and Apocalypse. That has nothing to do with anything. I'm so focused on these familiar relationships that I am going to feel cheated if that stuff isn't played out. Boom.
See, I feel like the familiar relationships could be used as a good way to bring characters in. Movies are always struggling to introduce these new characters. If Apocalypse decided to use, he's like, these people defeated me, I'm gonna go out, I'm gonna find their blood, I'm gonna turn their own blood against them, I'm gonna use these people to crush, kill, destroy. I like Hector's pick. Hector picked, like, a lot of really cool. He had that deep cut with Deathbird. She's like the alien angel, so we've got that in there. Sunfire, obviously excellent. You know, I Caliban, I didn't see him do too much except wear a suit in this new one. I'm sure maybe he has some powers. Right on. I'm into seeing him, more of him. Gambit is a fan favorite. Everybody likes Gambit, and yeah, he's been a good horseman in the past. I just feel like these are just, you know, some really good fan favorite choices that would make a great splash page, but I'm looking for like a pure destructive force. Ashley, Deadpool's great, but like Hector said, small doses. I feel like two things happen. He either annoys Apocalypse to the point where Apocalypse tries to kill him, and then that relationship is over, or he gets imbued with the power of Apocalypse and goes all Marvel kills, or kills the Marvel Universe style, and just tries to take out everyone, Apocalypse included. So I think that that's kind of a negative on Deadpool's part. I feel like Colossus is like B-grade strong guy in Marvel. If I was gonna pick somebody for this, maybe Juggernaut or even The Thing is available for Fox, or, you know, for them, for Sony or for Fox, whoever it is. They were talking about crossing over those universes. I'd be willing to see The Thing in that role. When I read Elixir, I was like, why is Ashley putting a healer on her team? Oh, I get it. She can go the other way too. Okay, he can hurt people. I gotcha. But he has to get close to you. He has to be able to put his hands on you to use his power. And if he uses it too much, he passes out. Not great warrior material on that one. And Iceman, yeah, Iceman's fine, except there is a reason that Apocalypse has picked like every other X-Men on the planet to be a horseman except Iceman because, you know, bottom tier. So that's what I have to say about those guys.
Ashley, you want to make some final arguments here?
All right, I'll do the best I can because, again, my comic knowledge is not as great as these two gentlemen, so I feel really out of my element right now.
Can I help you out, Ashley? I do want to point out that Iceman and Colossus, I'll help you out. They're super, super powerful. Iceman has been noted to be almost an Omega-level character. He's just very, like, underutilized in terms of his power level. And Colossus, too. Colossus became the Juggernaut at one point. He took down the Juggernaut. He's stronger, arguably,
but
than the
Thing. But he didn't have full control over those powers because he couldn't fully embrace being evil. He was never as strong as the Juggernaut.
But, Ryan, if he got overpowered by Apocalypse, he would be real strong.
Apocalypse has, like,
I like that.
So he could... I don't think Apocalypse, you know, knowing, because he obviously, he wouldn't pick Deadpool unless he, you know, saw something in him. He wouldn't give him so much power where it's like, okay, like, this guy is going to overpower me. Just give him just a touch of it, just a touch of it. And then, yeah, for, Elixir, I kind of was drawn to the fact that, again, Omega level, but also, like, I thought it would be really cool with, like, you know, like the way they can manipulate the molecules, and again, you know, sure, in the original powers, they have to be close to the person, but Apocalypse can make that, you know, range a lot larger if they want to, because it's, again, Apocalypse imbues people with power that they didn't normally have, and I think that he would be able to spread Elixir's range and, you know, manipulate them to do some damage, and then also maybe be able to do something where it's like, okay, you're not going to get wiped out as quickly as you normally would because, you know, you are my soldier and I will protect you. And then, for Colossus, you know, I think, he could, you know, his strength could be, you know, even greater through, Apocalypse's manipulation. And yeah, sure, like, he's a good guy at heart. I mean, we saw that in Deadpool where he was, like, throwing up because of, like, all the things Deadpool did and was very polite when Angel accidentally flashed him. But, you know, under Apocalypse's manipulation, you know, some of that niceness could be, you know, downplayed and, you know, his real self is not going to be able to, like, jump out and he's not going to realize that he is doing something that's wrong, you know, because again, when you're being manipulated through, you know, mutant powers, you don't have control of yourself as we've seen with several other characters. When I saw y'all's guys...
I just think that was a good interpretation of Colossus, but I think that was also the weakest interpretation of Colossus we've seen physically. He almost got choked out by Gina Carano. I feel like he's not...
They did the best they could with the budget that they had. You know, Fox did not want to pay any money for that movie because they thought it would make $2 at the box office because they don't know anything. I mean, look at the films that they've been making. They don't know how to handle their cinematic universe like Marvel knows how to handle theirs.
We wouldn't have a question if they'd have done a good job on Apocalypse, am I right?
And then when I saw y'all's team, and again, I know some of these characters, obviously, like I know Gambit off the top of my head, and that was pretty much the only one I knew, and then Caliban, oh, that was that guy in the movie, and then researching them, it's like, okay, but they were already on the team, why would you go with people that have failed you in the past? That's just the only thing I have to say about them.
They haven't been on the team in the movie yet.
Fantastic fight here, guys. Fantastic. Let's go to Tom, find out how many facts we butchered.
Actually, everything was pretty good. The only thing is it's argued whether or not Deadpool is a mutant, but we didn't say mutants, we said characters.
We did.
So, I mean, my biggest thing was that Iceman low tier thing, but Hector quickly jumped in on that and squashed it. So everything was pretty factual.
Yeah, I got
just
want to
say too.
Okay, yeah, so I got some people on Twitter, Billy's cracking jokes about how if Hector loses, you won't be allowed to go back on Knocking Dead again. And Langley says that, Ashley, way to go with sticking to the Four Horsemen motif. You can be in his squad any day.
Awesome. Nice. Thank you, Langley.
Yeah, you guys did a great job on this round. So obviously it's tough. We got a lot of characters being thrown around here. Brian, I'm going to say right off the bat, I think the problem with your argument is that you're all punch, but your punch doesn't really have a great way of fitting into the narratives that they're telling the way Ashley and Hector kind of brought them. You said, you know, I'm going for these guys because they can punch hard. They're a hit. They're a power for him. But I don't really, you didn't really give me enough about how they fit. So for me, it comes down to Ashley and Hector. Ashley, you did a fantastic job of arguing this one, by the way. I know you don't have as much comic knowledge as everybody else. You did a great job. One of the things I really liked about Ashley's argument is how she talks about how Apocalypse's ability to manipulate other mutants' powers and enhance them or change them in some way. You really gave a lot of thought to how Apocalypse would affect your characters and maybe enhance them in ways that we did not expect to make them more powerful, which I think is great. And Hector, it's clear that you had thought a lot about where your characters would fit into the continuity of the entire universe, how they would be used, how accurate they were, and they clearly fit into the worlds that we've already created and seen in the comic universe, but you've given an out for where we're at right now cinematically and how Fox could actually move forward. And I think when I look at the options in front of me, I think Hector really has a better grasp of where these characters belong, how they should fit in the films, and overall how they should go moving forward. I think it's a very close round, but I do have to give Hector the point for round two. So nice job, Hector.
Good job, Hector.
Ashley, very well thought.
Yeah, so everybody's teams would have been better than what they did in the movie. So,
absolutely.
Great.
For sure.
So the polls are agreeing with Jack this time. We got Hector's team at 63%, followed by Ashley at 25%, and then Brian way back at 13%.
Well done, guys. I finally picked one. Woohoo! Hector, something tells me the percentages are going to be high for this poll for you throughout. So every time I don't pick you, I'm probably going to go against it. Well done, guys. That was a fantastic fight. Excellent job. We are now moving on to round three. Ding, ding. So, Hector, you host a little show called Knocking Dead for the Screen Junkies on the Screen Junkies Plus Network this past spring, where it provided an honest recap of the second half of the hit show The Walking Dead and all of its many flaws. So I wanted to ask the question to you guys. What would you all say is the best zombie movie of all time? And for this round, Brian, you are going to lead us off.
Oh, great. So I picked the 1978 Dawn of the Dead. Obviously it's hard to follow up a movie that pretty much created the modern zombie. I mean, before George Romero, zombies in movies were mostly, it was like Haitian voodoo type stuff, and there weren't really any kind of defined rules. You know, he brought the whole thing with the actual Walking Dead. And this is a rare sequel that is considered not on par by most, but by many better than even the original. They use the amazing shopping mall setting as not only a place to do great work with zombies and these crowds, but also to set up the whole satire, the idea of consumerism and, how humans are zombies and the mall is their mecca that we all come. I mean, it's just, I'm not going to go into the whole, I'm not going to try to explain the whole satire of what's great about Dawn of the Dead, except to say that it is a well-known, that it works on multiple levels. It's a great actual zombie movie. It's a great, play on consumer culture. The amazing practical effects by Tom Savini. I mean, in this era, but then on, he obviously went on to do some amazing work. This is a movie that even Roger Ebert said was one of the best horror films ever made, and this is a man who was not big into genre film. He didn't like Night of the Living Dead, but he got what this movie was trying to do. He got that it was using the extreme violence and the, you know, the zombie metaphor and what it was trying to get through. This is a movie that it's so good that even Zack Snyder couldn't screw up the remake, so that's gotta be saying something. I mean, that's a strong statement. Also, gamers like me might have enjoyed Dead Rising, which was a great zombie game that was totally ripped right off of Dawn of the Dead, where you got to fight through a mall. But I just think that it was groundbreaking, even though it was a sequel. It's given us so many of the things that we consider to be zombie tropes and cliches were born from this movie. I just think it's amazing.
All right. Sounds great. Ashley, who did you pick?
All right, so I picked the 2004 Edgar Wright film, Shaun of the Dead, which is an independent film. I think a lot of people forget that because of how, like, such a cult following it has. But Shaun of the Dead is, you know, maybe people say, like, oh, that's just like a parody of zombie movies. No, it's really an homage to all of the classic tropes that were set up in with the George A. Romero zombie films. And I think it's like a love letter to the whole genre. And it's funny and it has stakes as well. George A. Romero himself said that he was so impressed with the film that he actually asked Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright to be in his movie Land of the Dead as a cameo parts to play zombies because, again, you know, the godfather of the genre thought that this movie was good. Quentin Tarantino also dubbed Shaun of the Dead one of the top 20 films made since 1992. And, again, it's not a parody, it's an homage to all of the classics, and I think it holds up on its own as a really great original story, in that vein where it's like, okay, like we have these two losers, you know, Ed and Sean, and you know, they're just trying to like live their life, and they don't even really notice all of the things going around them, they're just, you know, they're doing their day to day, and then, it's like when they're like called to, like when they realize like what's going on and like especially Sean, like this is his chance to shine and like become like a more dynamic person than just like a guy that's a manager of teenagers at an appliance store. And so I think the narrative is really strong, with him like traveling around and like trying to go from location to location because, you know, anytime you have zombies, you know, one stronghold like in Dawn of the Dead, that's not going to last forever. You do have to keep moving. And so I think that they were able to like go to different locations and like keep the film narrative pace moving that way, very action packed, even though they only filmed it for 4 million pounds. I think the visual effects look really good. They don't look too dated or anything, even though it came out 12 years ago. And just, it's a really fun movie that you could watch anytime and holds up.
Yeah, one awesome. Of my favorites for sure. All right, Hector, that means you're going last, sir. Who did you pick?
You got it. I'll try to keep it short. I went with the most recent zombie movie, 2013's World War Z, starring Brad Pitt. I think that Brad Pitt is a fantastic actor. He's criminally underrated as an actor. Everybody thinks of him as a movie star and being really good looking, but he turns in a really, really great performance. This is a movie that came from how Brad Pitt's kids liked zombies. So he's like, I want to do a zombie movie. That's not a good enough reason to do a movie, but somehow this thing turned out great. It had production problems. It had script problems. It was adapted from the idea of the Max Brooks novel. And it, even despite all of that, the end result, the end product of this movie, World War Z, was, I think, way better than people expected it to be. I think hardcore critics were ready to jump on this movie, and it came out, and it delivered just an incredibly entertaining, thrilling, straightforward, modern zombie story and world that was able to be told in a kind of a limited movie format. All of these zombie movies, you know, the whole thing about The Walking Dead is Robert Kirkman, and I agree with him, it's like it's too little time to explain this entire world and to see these characters move forward and all that other stuff and to come with a semi-satisfactory resolution. But World War Z was able to do it, which is kind of nuts. Years after all of these movies, all the different movies that you guys picked broke ground in terms of what zombie films even are, or in terms of paying homage to the movies. Here comes World War Z that was PG-13 on top of that. Now, you might mark that as something to go against, but I think that it helped the storytelling. It didn't rely on overuse of gore or shock value or anything like that. You're still able to feel incredible moments of tension and fear and suspense while still giving you, again, a pretty satisfactory resolution within the time span of a two-hour, two-and-a-half-hour film that I think was fantastic. I think Brad Pitt is a really, really high-caliber actor, and I think that World War Z is going to stand the test of time as being just a classic, straightforward zombie movie.
All right. Guys, fight.
All right. When I was watching World War Z recently, like, to me, it felt kind of like a Roland Emmerich film where it's like, it's just like a, kind of like more of a thriller, and like the zombie thing was kind of an afterthought. That's how I felt. And it just felt like, okay, we got Brad Pitt's character, whom I'm sorry, I cannot remember the character's name, but it's like, he's like the Gary Stu. He can do everything. And, I just felt like, I didn't feel like there was a whole lot of stakes, even though, like, obviously, like, you could turn, like, what, within 12 seconds of, like, being bit by a zombie. And, you know, the turnaround time was really quick. He had to do a lot of, like, things like chop off that one lady's arm so that she wouldn't get infected. But even then, it's like, okay, well, this guy's kind of like a modern Superman or whatever you want to say. Like, I didn't feel like he was ever really in danger at any point in the movie. I'm like, okay, this feels a lot like a low, like, not a low budget, but, like this makes me think of Independence Day, but, like, I was compelled by Independence Day. This was just kind of like, okay, it's a fun little action movie, but, you know, best zombie movie, I wouldn't rank it among the best zombie movies. I would have probably picked several other movies before I would pick World War Z. And then for Dawn of the Dead, I felt like I know, Brian, you mentioned that, like, oh, it's supposed to be a satire on consumerism, but I think sometimes in the movie, and I don't know if it was the runtime or what, but it kind of felt like a, like, are they really satirizing it, or is it more like they're kind of confused and don't know what tone that they want to go with the movie? And then being trapped in the, like, the mall for that
long. Depends on what cut of the movie you saw, too. There's a couple different cuts of the movie.
Well, so. I had a hard time finding the movie to stream online. I do not own the DVD, so I had to go to some dubious sources, so I don't know what cut I saw, but it was really, really long.
And I don't want to pile on Hector, because we were just talking, but Ashley was talking about World War Z, so let me just get it out of the way. Was that with her? I had when I saw his choice, I actually wrote down, is Hector taking this seriously? But then I didn't have a problem with World War Z. I think World War Z is a fine, like, kind of a bland action movie. It's like the safest, most Hollywood version of a zombie movie, kind of like I Am Legend. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's just like with movies out there like the original Night of the Living Dead, 28 Days Later, Dead Alive, Reanimator, even something like Zombieland, I don't think it's fair to call World War Z the best zombie movie ever. Hold up, but I don't think it's held up 2 years, you know, or however long it's been since it came out. I feel like we've already kind of forgotten about it as a culture and are just on to the next zombie thing. And for Ashley's pick, obviously everybody loves Shaun of the Dead. It's great, and it's got great moments, but everything exists because of Romero. All the stuff that's in that movie, I mean, it has its own original plot, but there's names, there's references, it's all based on tributing Dawn of the Dead and Night of the Living Dead. If you were to ask Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg their favorite zombie movie, they would tell you Dawn of the Dead. And I think that speaks strongly. I mean, I know that's a great movie and we all love it, but when it comes down to it, it's only tributing the best.
Hector, why don't you start us off on some final thoughts?
You got it. I love Shaun of the Dead. I think it's fantastic, but the reason I didn't pick it is because, to me, it's not a zombie film. It's a comedy. It is a comedy with the backdrop of a zombie movie, and it is a fantastic comedy. And there is a character as well, Shaun himself, who I really never felt like he was in danger, talking about how you didn't think that Brad Pitt was in danger. I think that every zombie film has that sort of central main protagonist character who you know is gonna carry us through the events in the movie, and the other characters that you meet are probably gonna die, so on and so forth. And I love Shaun, like I said, it's just, to me it's a comedy film, it is not something that I go, this is one of the best zombie movies of all time. This is really telling us about us as a culture, as a society. It's a comedy. It does a lot of those things, but it is a comedy first and foremost, and then a zombie film. And Dawn of the Dead is fantastic. It's really, really great. But this is a movie that I think a lot of nostalgia affects how we view it still to this day. I think that it being the first doesn't necessarily mean that you should give it credit for being better than something that, like even Shaun of the Dead can kind of improve upon, even though Shaun is just a tribute, like you said, Brian. Just want to quote Gene Shalit of NBC's Today said about Dawn of the Dead back in the day, "Yawn of the Living" is what he said. A lot of people say that the special effects, that the gore, that all of that sort of thing that was really groundbreaking and shock value for back in the day, it takes away from any sort of character development. The acting is very wooden. That's why I really think that World War Z is fantastic, because it has a great cast and a great performance in Brad Pitt. I think that with something like Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, because of how over-the-top gory it is, because of the headshots, because of all those iconic things, that it becomes laughable because you don't connect with any of the characters emotionally, because you know it just becomes about the special effects. And people say that the real star of the movie is Tom Savini, who was the special effects guy for Romero. And it's just, it resulted in a loss of impact in terms of an emotional level. So that's why Dawn of the Dead, I don't think, even though it was an originator and improved upon Night of the Living Dead from the 50s, it's something that you go back and you objectively look at as a film and you go, okay, well, the characters aren't working. The backdrop and everything does, but doesn't give you that full experience.
Ashley.
All right, and then to kind of make some other points about Shaun of the Dead, it's, you know, compared to the other two movies, it's won more awards. It won the Saturn Award for the best horror film, one of Bram Stoker, and a British Independent Film Award for the best screenplay. It also won an International Horror Guild and a Rondo Classic Horror Award for the best film. So yes, like, I know it's an homage to the zombie genre, that it builds upon things from the past, but just because something builds upon something from the past and it didn't come first, like, that doesn't necessarily mean it's not the best. It's, again, the story is great. I think out of the three films, it's definitely a stronger zombie movie than World War Z, and I think it holds up a lot better than Dawn of the Dead, which, if you try to show that to a modern audience, especially someone in, like, my target demographic, which are, you know, like, 15-year-old kids, because I'm a teacher, if you showed them that movie, they would be like, oh, my God, this is so boring, miss. Why are we even watching this if I were allowed to show such an unrated film in class? You know, with Shaun of the Dead, they would be excited, and, you know, they obviously would not have seen all of the other zombie movies that play homage to it, and I don't think everybody that was a fan of that film even, you know, maybe had seen all of those until that film, you know, introduced them to these things. It's like, as you watch the film and become interested in it, like, for me, it's like, okay, like, now I want to see what these films are that that it's paying homage to, like, especially with, like, Night of the Living Dead. I mean, they have that iconic line, like, "We're coming to get you, Barbara," and all sorts of other, like, little references that, like, you go watch those other movies and then you go back and see this, and it's like, oh, like, now I really see these cool things the filmmaker's doing. Again, the story is a lot more engaging than Dawn of the Dead, and again, I think it just fits the zombie tropes a little stronger than World War Z, which is a, to me, like, a generic action film.
Brian, finish us off.
You know, I feel like I'm really glad that we don't let 15-year-olds decide what the best of all time is, because it's not up to their CGI standards. You know, there's groundbreaking filmmaking going on in Dawn of the Dead. There are practical effects that had never been done before. And you know, you guys, maybe it's not all laid out on the surface for every person to get, but there are some really deep themes, and there are some great characters. Ken Forey's lead character in that movie is an amazing performance, and probably like a top-level horror survivor character. You know, I just feel like the elements of the what they're trying to tell with the zombie story, but also what underlies it all, I feel like there are comedy elements, there's over-the-top moments, but there's still tension. You know, there's even an element of, like, the people in the actual mall themselves start to kind of become bored with their situation. You know, it's all fun and games at the beginning, and then they realize that they are trapped and they can't hold out there forever, like you said, and they, you know, there's that desperation to leave and the thing, they thought they were safe and they're not. It's just, I feel like there's a lot going on, and just because modern audiences aren't akin to it and they need everything spoon-fed to them and they can't handle something that didn't come out of a computer and is really there on screen for them to look at doesn't detract from a movie that has stood the test of time.
All right. That is a great round, guys. Tom, what do we got?
Factually, this was pretty good. Brian said that if you were to ask Edgar Wright what his favorite zombie movie would be, it would be Dawn of the Dead. It actually was Night of the Living Dead. Fun fact, though, Romero's favorite zombie movie has been listed as Shaun of the Dead. And they are both tied at a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. So this is tough.
Yeah, seriously.
So we got a lot of love for some other movies. They all liked your choices. A lot of people saying those are also their top three, but honorable mentions for Dead Snow, Night of the Living Dead, of course, and the 28 Days Later franchise. And a lot of people were saying that they were hating on World War Z. They were saying it had amazing source material, but it wasted its potential.
Yeah, this was not an easy pick. And just so everybody can I can throw this out there, you know, it's based on the arguments, not necessarily the picks. So, of course, there's always going to be that movie where we're like, of course it's that answer. But if someone can pull out an argument for why World War Z, for example, is better than Shaun of the Dead, then they should certainly deserve to win. Now, I don't think Hector has done that, so that's why he's eliminated first this round. However, I will say that, Hector, you did pick Shaun of the Dead, and so did Ashley, and I figured since you're the veteran, it made sense to let Ashley keep that pick and give you a shot at a different title. So just so everyone knows, Hector also thinks that Shaun of the Dead is better than World War Z.
We've all had to do that before, Hector. You just lie the whole time.
and the big argument against World War Z for me, Ashley, I think, gave it was that Brad can do everything in that movie. He's unrealistic. You don't feel connection to his character. Everybody sort of, you know, he's not you in that situation. He's just super Brad Pitt. So for me, it did come down to, Ashley and Brian. And Brian, you made a lot of great points here about how, you know, it was almost better than the original. Night of the Living Dead is really the movie that many say starts the zombie genre. And Dawn of the Dead takes a new take on that and takes that one step further in a better way. It's a fantastic movie. Ashley, when you're talking about the homage of Shaun of the Dead to all these other films, one of the things that kind of stuck with me first was that, you know, if you're an homage to another film, then doesn't that make the other film better because that's why you're, you know, giving it an homage, and Brian made that point. However, I think it's kind of undeniable that, you know, even Romero loves Shaun of the Dead. Shaun of the Dead takes every element that you love about zombie films and makes it into one movie. And even though Hector called it just a comedy, it's not just a comedy. It's a comedy surrounded by zombies. I think that point was well made by Ashley. So, Ashley, you win the point for this round. Congratulations.
Oh, man.
Well
Did
done.
I expect that.
So, excellent Rough job move. For you.
Do I hear the poll?
I do. Kimber, what do we got?
So you said everybody was going to agree with Hector regardless, but they proved us wrong on that one because he only got 8% with the World War Z on this one. Dawn of the Dead got a 33%, but the audience definitely agreed. Shaun of the Dead, definitely the winner, 58%.
Well done, Ashley. It was a very good fight. That means with 2 points already, Ashley, you are guaranteed to move forward into the lightning round. Well done. Hector, you have 1 point, and our champion, Brian, is still with a goose egg.
Getting shut out over here.
Getting shut out today. So, Ashley, if you manage to win another point here today, just so you know, there is a special benefit going into the lightning round, so keep trying for that. As we move to round four, Ding Ding. This is going to be an easy question. I don't have a story for it. What's the best black and white movie of all time? And I'd like to start with you, Ash.
All right. So when I think of the best black and white movie of all time, the answer is automatically one of my favorite movies, and not just because it teaches this book every year to my students. It's the 1962 classic To Kill a Mockingbird, directed by Robert Mulligan and starring Gregory Peck as the iconic Atticus Finch. Do you need me to say anything else about the movie?
Yeah, give it a little bit here.
Alright, so this is a tale of not only Atticus Finch trying to defend Tom Robinson, who is falsely accused of assaulting Amelia Yule, who is from the very hated family of the Yules in the tiny town of Macomb, Alabama. But it's also the story of Scout and Jim, Atticus's Atticus is a single father. He does have some help from his maid Calpurnia, but this is set in like 1932, so like to have a character that's even a single father, I thought that was very outstanding. And then just the kind of story that they're telling, is set in 1932, but even at the height of the civil rights movement in 1962 is a very brave story to tell. Cinematically, because the heart of the country was definitely not, was turning towards the tide of civil rights, but definitely was not there yet. So this is a very brave film to, put on screen. And, it was 1962. They color film, Technicolor, two-tone, three-tone, that's been around for quite a long time, 1939 with The Wizard of Oz was in color. So they could have chosen to put this film in color, but they stylistically chose to go with black and white so that, that setting, that nostalgic setting of 1932 could be better captured than, just going with the easy choice, the money-making choice of, putting something in what they call glorious Technicolor if they use that brand of film stock, because there are different ones.
Do you have anything else you want to say for now, or do you want to hold on?
This film was so important that on its 50th anniversary release, which was a few years ago, that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, had it aired on television commercial-free and had a very special address before the film talking about how, in these times where we have situations with, like, Trayvon Martin and all these other things going on in our society, that this film is still important to our country and its message is timeless and we still have a long way to go.
Wonderful. Brian, you're going to go next.
For my pick, I picked the classic Citizen Kane. I didn't
it's
pick
the Citizen Kane
because
of Citizen Kane movies.
The Citizen Kane of Citizen Kane movies, absolutely. Now, I didn't pick this because it's the obvious answer. It is legitimately one of my all-time favorite films. I like a lot of movie fans, I think, you start out on blockbusters and stuff, and it takes a long time. I knew it did for me, and there's been a lot of disappointments where I went back and looked at older films, and, they don't hold up, like we just talked about in the last round. Sometimes you go back to something and, people who were stage actors on film or whatever, it isn't portrayed the way you expect, and it just doesn't strike you. Citizen Kane didn't have any of these problems for me. I'm sitting there, I'm watching these amazing performances and the way this story is being told, and I'm realizing all these things that I've seen in films all my life were in this movie that had kind of spawned in this original piece. Orson Welles was breaking new ground in storytelling and filmmaking. I had a quote here from BBC.com because I couldn't put my thoughts into words very well. It's a 114-minute film school, providing lessons in deep focus and rear projection, extreme close-up, and overlapping dialogue. The modern style of movie that we think of today doesn't exist without Citizen Kane. He's using nonlinear storytelling with multiple narrators, multiple perspectives. He's even bouncing around through multiple genres. The movie starts out with this gothic shot of the castle, but then it becomes like a newsroom, war propaganda movie, and then a political drama, and there's behind-the-scenes Hollywood, all under the banner of the story, this biopic of a character, a living man who was so powerful that he literally crushed the film and Welles' career. And that's another thing that makes Citizen Kane such not just such an amazing movie, but a piece of film history, is that the behind-the-scenes story is just as interesting as what went on to the screen. Welles was a man making a movie about a megalomaniac, and he himself was a megalomaniac, a 25-year-old or 29, however old he was, filmmaker, writer, director, producer, with all... and star with all the power to do whatever he want from the studio, Can you imagine what would happen, like, what would happen for a studio to give a person that kind of power now?
It's called J.J. Abrams.
but he didn't have a proven record like J.J. Abrams does now, you know what I mean? And then, you know, as amazing and brilliant as the movie is and as Wells was, the movie itself then goes on to parallel Wells' own life. And if you look at it through that lens, you see how he himself became the Charles Foster Kane of his own world and descended into this kind of sad end. You know, it's just, it's not, I didn't pick it because it was the easy choice. I picked it because it's an amazing film.
All right. Hector, you're going to cap it off here. Who'd you pick?
Oh my God, you guys, you make it so hard. Those are freaking awesome movies. And I picked a movie that isn't really in the same category on a lot of levels, but it's definitely the coolest black and white movie. And I picked Sin City, which was released in 2005. And I think you could argue, you could debate that it is the best adaptation of a comic book or graphic novel of one art medium to another. I think that it is so brilliant and it is so well done and it is so perfectly in the vibe and in the tone of that classic film noir. It's super violent, it's hyper violent, but it's so stylized and so cool. The way that they use color in that movie is beautiful. It's inspirational. I think that it blew a lot of people away when it came out. I think that the movie is something that is rewatchable for me because there is such a great job of interweaving stories and an incredible ensemble cast that it's endlessly rewatchable. And yeah, like I said, I think that it's really cool to see how it's the year 2005 and a studio can go and decide to make a movie that is predominantly in black and white, but there are specific reasons for that. It's recreating a predominantly black and white graphic novel. And I think that technically speaking and it's so well done. And then in terms of everything else, the story is really compelling and it's fun and it's over the top and it's horrifying and it's graphic and it's emotional and it's surprising how much emotion you can get out of something that is so stylized, that is so, in so many ways, cartoony or graphic-y in terms of its original medium, which was the Sin City series of novels from Frank Miller. So for those reasons I'm going, I think the best black and white film is Sin City.
All right, guys, go ahead and fight.
Well, I have to say, I like Sin City a lot, and I do think it's probably the best adaptation of a graphic novel. And I think it's really good. But I also take umbrage with the idea of it being a black and white movie, because what it really is a highly stylized movie where they use color very specifically to invoke emotion from you, to draw your attention to things. It looks great and it's done well, but I just feel like it's more about the style. Like, you know, it's more color corrected on a computer than it is black and white, and it's meant to evoke the images from the book, which it does successfully. As far as To Kill a Mockingbird, you can't say bad things about To Kill a Mockingbird. That's a great film. I feel like it does have the one detriment that, again, we're talking about, it's using being a black and white film as a style choice to take people to a different era, to try and invoke a different feeling, whereas my film is only black and white because that is the medium the man needed. He was trying to get his vision onto the screen and into the world however it took him. And that's what he had at his disposal at the time. It's the truest black and white film because he is trying to reach for the stars. He's not going backwards to use black and white as a tool on you. He is taking the black and white because that's what he has at his disposal right now. He's using it to the best of his abilities, and he's making the best film he can make at the time it came out.
Which is funny because at the time when Citizen came out, I mean, color film stock, you know, Technicolor or Kodak color, whatever you want, was readily available. During your film's time and in my film's time, there were separate categories for film that was on color and film that was black and white. Our films were both nominated for Oscars in the black and white film category. So I don't think that's a fair point to make. If he
all
could
right,
have
fair
chosen
enough
to make
so
Citizen Kane.
Yeah. Totally. Sin City also nominated for Best Black and White Movie. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that totally existed in 2005.
They brought that category back that year, I think.
Yeah, it's one film in that category. Mm-hmm. Don't knock balls this, we know better. your film was shot on green screen, and when you rewatch it on like a little television like I have in my house, it shows really, I don't think the effects are as beautiful as they were in 2005, which is sad because it's only 11 years in the past. Plus, your film, I can't remember if it was Rodriguez or Miller said, it wasn't an adaptation, more so as a translation from the page to screen, and it really shows in the narrative devices. Like, half the film, I felt like, how many more voiceovers are we going to have in this movie? Stylistically, yes, it's very beautiful, but, you know, film is a visual medium, and the weakest device that you have at your disposal in a visual medium is have your character espouse exposition through narration. As far as, you know, going back to award-winning things, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird and Citizen Kane, again, both nominated for Oscars. My film won 3 of them, not only Best Actor for Gregory Peck's portrayal of Atticus Finch, but it also won Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Art Direction for a black and white film. It was also nominated for its cinematography, Best Picture, Director, Score, and Supporting Actress of Mary Benham. I think this is a very unique film in that it has, you know, child actors that are actually really good actors. Normally when you see children actors in films, no matter the era, they kind of stick out like sore thumbs, but these felt like real children, and that's attributed to Robert Mulligan letting them kind of just play and be kids and then kind of filming around that, you know, making it feel more natural. And, you know, Brian, you said again, like, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird using the black and white film stock as a stylistic choice. Well, that is something that, you know, directors have at their disposal. All directors make choices like that. You know, it's not like pandering to anybody or anything like that. You know, you do what you have to do to get your message across, and, you know, trying to, you know, ensure that, you know, like, this is a nostalgic time period. They had to make them realize, you know, this is not just something that's in our modern time for 1962, but to harken back to what it was like in the Jim Crow South of the 1930s, which the novel and the film are set, and how really, you know, not many things had changed from that time period. Yes, there were more freedoms, but there was still a lot of prejudice. And that's why this film, I think, stands the test of time a little better than Citizen Kane, because we still are dealing with these issues in our society, and I think this film is just a little more relatable than some of the themes in Citizen Kane. Yes, we have megalomaniacs in our society, but I think the racial issues of To Kill a Mockingbird stand up a little better. And plus, I mean, I feel so bad for Orson Welles. That film ruined the career that he had that was so illustrious. I mean,
that's part of what makes that story so interesting, too, and what makes that film so great, and how the film itself parallels the reality of the making and the distribution of the film. Now, taking the whole style, black and white style thing off the table, I also do feel that although To Kill a Mockingbird's a great story, well told, great characters, it's also a very straightforward movie where Citizen Kane is taking a lot more chances in the types of filmmaking he's doing at the time. He's trying new things, he's trying new storytelling techniques, new shooting techniques, you know, things that are considered you know, something that's just very basic that you do with a lens nowadays was something that was considered a special effect for them, and he was breaking new ground all the time. And this wasn't a guy who had experience in as much in film. You know, he was coming from radio, he had resisted coming to into film, and for him to come in with almost no knowledge of film, or a limited knowledge of film compared to his radio history, and do so much and change so many things and create so many things that we're still using today. The movie itself may not be as relatable, but the things that it gave us in filmmaking and in storytelling have permeated all of our movie culture.
I want to hear more about SimCity and how it fits into the black and white genre here.
Absolutely. You know, like we were saying earlier, all three of these movies chose black and white for stylistic choices. The question wasn't what's the best movie that came out before 1942, it was what's the best black and white film. And I think that the reason that Sin City uses black and white, on top of adapting from a comic book, is because it is evoking the film noir style. That is why you have the voiceover. That is what the comic book itself did, which was trying to evoke that from classic film noir cinema. So then Sin City, in that regard, is way more successful than the comic book ever could be, even though it's a book and it's doing everything it's supposed to be doing, because the Sin City film is supposed to be bringing you back to that era of that gritty film noir detective story and the serialized stories that were told back in the day in movies. And it does it in a brilliant way. And if you, if you're going to say that Schindler's List is black and white, even though it has a use of color for a very specific reason, then of course absolutely Sin City is black and white. For those, again, those specific reasons. It does use color in striking ways. It uses color to emphasize things. It uses color to bring out emotion and drama. And it does a great job of it. And this is a movie that, you know, again, Citizens Kane came out in 1941. I think 8 movies were released that year. In 1962, To Kill a Mockingbird came out, and I think 13 movies were released that year. I think 9,804 movies were released in 2005. You can fact check that. And to have a movie come out that year that also comes from a comic book, which there are just a way too many amount of movies that are adapted from comics, and to still have a kind of a lasting impact and to change the genre and to change the movie industry as much as it did. I mean, movies are getting greenlit still to this day because the pitch is, it's like Sin City, but this. It's like Sin City, but that. It made an incredible splash from Robert Rodriguez, who is normally an independent film director for the most part. He even got in trouble for trying to give directing credit to Frank Miller himself, who was a comic book guy, and the Directors Guild had a problem with that. So it shook up the industry in its own ways. It helped a lot of careers and highlighted some awesome, some really great performances and stuff from actors that we haven't really seen even since then. So in those ways, I think Sin City is something that should be praised for all of the different things that it did. Plus, it's just so endlessly entertaining. There's not a frame in that movie that's boring. It's awesome. It's cool. It's the coolest. Sin City.
All right. So that sounds like kind of your final thoughts on that. Let's get, Brian, your final thoughts.
You know, like I said, I think Sin City's an amazing writing, directorial, you know, starring tour de force by Orson Welles. It gave us a peek at some great potential that we unfortunately never realized. It's an amazing film. It's also an amazing Hollywood story. It broke new ground in filmmaking, and I just think it stands the test of time.
All right, and Ashley.
All right, so a point was brought up earlier about, like, well, like, To Kill a Mockingbird is a very straightforward story. I think it's a little more complicated than that because of the racial injustice themes that play along with it, plus the, like, the childhood, I'm trying to think of the words right now, like, they're totally running away from me, which is always funny. There's a lot more going on than just a simple narrative of, like, here's these kids and their dad's having to deal with this, you know, bad thing that happened, and people are, like, calling him inappropriate words that I will not say on the internet. The film itself, because of its straightforward story, like, they didn't even want to make, the studio didn't want to make the movie, because it didn't have that romantic plot or a lot of action. It's just a story of a tired old town that's, you know, backwards, you know, well, not backwards for that time period, unfortunately. But, you know, it's a Macomb is a tired old town, and people need to learn to be more tolerant of each other, because it's wrong to accuse people of things that they didn't that did not happen because you're trying to save face, which is what Mayella tried to do. You know, she accused Tom Robinson of assault so that her own father, who was the real criminal of the story and really did all those awful things, like, she didn't want to get in further trouble. You know, To Kill a Mockingbird is a very special film, not only because of its 50th anniversary, and again, you know, wanting to show it commercial-free on television, which, you know, that's a huge deal. You know, that's their time to make money, you know, with commercials. And it was also placed in the National Film Registry in 1995 to preserve it because, again, it's culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant to our time. And, again, I think it holds up just as well as today as it did in the past, and as President Obama said in his speech, you know, it's about doing what's right when it's hard, and this film still speaks to us.
Oh, ding. Great round, guys. Wow. All right, Tom, what do I need to know?
I I googled, is Sin City a black and white movie, and I didn't get a no. I also googled, is it the coolest one, and I also didn't get a no. Everything was pretty factually clean. Luckily, Ashley tipped me off before I got Nightfalls. And I'm sure Kimber has some good stuff.
Yeah, Morgan at the Purple Dawn said this is the single most difficult question he's ever been asked. I know he's a classic movies guy. But also just like a lot of really cool suggestions for movies. I would have liked to see them all fought. We got Clerks, King Kong, Eraserhead, Psycho, It's a Wonderful Life, Schindler's List. It was pretty endless,
Raging
and all
Bull's
of them were awesome.
One.
Yeah, Raging Bull was on there.
Yeah, there's a lot of great black and white movies, a lot more than people would think. When I saw Sim City, right away I was like, oh yeah, Sim City.
And also,
Sim City is a video game.
This is by far the closest poll today.
In black and white.
I'm sorry, Kimber, what was that?
So this was by far the closest in the polls today as well.
Someone's going to walk away hating me. All right.
I'm glad that we got to talk about a subject I actually know about for once. I have my minor is in film studies, and I've seen Citizen Kane 12 times because I had to write a paper about that deep depth of focus photography. So yeah.
No one,
that was pretty cool.
No one will dispute that Ash came to the table without some facts in this round because you really brought some knowledge. Hector, I love Sin City.
It's okay, bye.
It's a great movie. You're not out of it yet. It's a great movie. I do love everything about the film and you know, the film noir style of it. The problem is you're going up against Citizen Kane and To Kill a Mockingbird.
I know.
Which is really tough. You know, if just a little behind the scenes information, they don't know what they're picking until the end. Like they pick, but they don't know what they're picking against. So everybody gets their answers once they're all been given. So you don't know what you're going up against. So for me, it comes down to the Citizen Kane and Citizen Kane movies and To Kill a Mockingbird. And I think there's a lot of information here. It's really tough. Citizen Kane gives us a lot of groundbreaking narrative telling, storytelling, the way Brian mentioned it. He took a lot of narrative risks. He was everything in this movie, writer, director, producer, actor. Very true. To Kill a Mockingbird is one of the most important films for very similar reasons. Like you said, with Obama saying it has a very important message. The thing that really struck out for me about To Kill a Mockingbird and the thing I would have loved a little bit more out of Orson Welles' Citizen Kane was three Oscars, including art direction for a black and white film, which to me is a really key factor here, especially in a round about black and white movies.
But it should be pointed out that my movie got buried by William Randolph Hearst, and he held sway over the voting committees of the Oscars and things like that. There are things at play that were working against Citizen Kane.
Every time the movie got mentioned at the Oscars, it got booed that year? Is William
Randolph
Hearst?
The irony is...
Yeah, that is.
The irony is it's about to get buried here on Fan Friction as well because, Ashley, you are winning round four.
Man, I'm shutting out.
And, Ashley, you will have a special bonus available to you in the lightning round. You were the first person to earn the bonus, so congratulations.
You know I'm going to need that because that is not strength I have. We all remember I am number four.
Yeah, when it comes to,
my neighbors have that movie in their collection, apparently. We were looking for movies last night, and it's like, really?
So that leaves us one final round.
Hector, did you want to hear the poll real quick?
Oh, yes, please, I do want to hear the poll.
They actually disagreed with you. We got To Kill a Mockingbird at 27%, while Citizen Kane and Sin City, in a surprising twist, both tie at 36%.
Wow.
I'm going to say why that is, because people that voted haven't seen Citizen Kane, that's why. Everyone has seen Sin City, they're voting, that's why.
Citizen Kane
and
is one of those movies.
And if you haven't seen To Kill a Mockingbird, you should see it, it's really good. And read the book, it's good too.
Citizen Kane is a tough movie that doesn't quite hold up to younger audiences because they don't get it. But there's a really strong message to Citizen Kane, and it's one of those movies. If you love movies, it's worth pursuing that film and learning why this movie is so important, because it really
and
is.
Researching all of the historical things that Brian said, because all of that is so true. Like William Randolph Hearst, really, he wanted that movie destroyed so that nobody could ever see it again.
He buried it. He refused to let it be reviewed in any of his papers, and he controlled like 90% of the papers on the planet at the time. Like it.
Yeah.
So right now the score stands. Ashley, you have 3 points. Hector, you have 1 point. Brian, you have no points. Brian, you need this one to stay alive as we go into the final round, round five. It seems a safe bet that Captain America Civil War is probably going to be the number one highest grossing movie of the summer. So I want to know what's number two. Hector, start us off.
This summer, the number two highest grossing movie is Suicide Squad's To Lose. This movie has everything going for it. This is the type of film that is now predicted to be the runaway hit, the subversive runaway hit, because it got greenlit, absolutely got greenlit, because of a little movie called Guardians of the Galaxy. So right now, superhero movies are top at the box office. This is a superhero villain movie. This is something that is entirely fresh. It's a combination of Guardians of the Galaxy and Deadpool, which was another surprise hit, the highest grossing X-Men movie in the entire franchise, which is nuts, being rated R, which is crazy. Suicide Squad is going to be PG-13, so that's even going to be more helpful for it to make money. This is the movie that audiences are waiting for. They're frothing at the mouth for it. They want something different with their superhero cinema. They were really disappointed by Batman, Superman, Dawn of Justice, and it is very clear from the marketing of this movie, which so far has been top-notch, that this is a 180-degree different film than that movie. Plus, it still has Batman in it, and everyone loves Batman. Everybody loves the Joker. Everybody loves Harley Quinn. And people are going to be blown away by lesser characters that people are going to go into the theater and have no sort of higher expectations about. Nobody cares about Deadshot until we see Will Smith's performance as Deadshot. People care about characters like Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman. So when that movie misses the mark, it really shows in the box office numbers. So this movie is going to be the needed and easily won second number two of this summer in terms of box office, because this is what audiences want. You can see that the shift has been moving into this place from Guardians of the Galaxy when it came out a few years back, and everybody's ready for it. So Suicide Squad, number two.
All right. Ash, what'd you pick?
All right, I kind of feel like I went with a dark horse pick. I picked the other animated movie that's coming out this summer on July 8th, The Secret Life of Pets, which is kind of like, it's like the Toy Story, but about pets, because we get to see what their lives are when their owners are not around. This is from the same people that made Despicable Me, so I think that, you know, because it's something that's like a, you know, kind of an original idea, it's not based off of a previous franchise, whether that be comics or other iconic films that are coming out, I think it could have a good chance to get in that family audience that maybe doesn't, you know, that can't go see Suicide Squad. I'm like totally going crazy right now. That's not going to be able to go see that film. Plus, you know, because kids love repetition and they love to go see the same thing over and over again. So I could see that this, you know, maybe it has the potential kind of like Zootopia did earlier in the spring movie season, you know, which made like way, like millions of dollars. I don't know the box office off the top of my head, but you know, animals are popular with children. Children love seeing the same thing over and over again. I think that could have a potential to earn this film, which, you know, has great trailers. You know, even I was like, oh wow, I really want to go see that movie. And I'm not normally one that's going to go see something that's definitely marketed, you know, just for children. So I think that family audience, it's going to, you know, get that niche where, you know, it's an original property, but it's based, you know, but it's from people that have brought us great things before, so I think it has the potential to be good.
All right, Brian,
what's sneak in there.
You know, I like what Ashley said about people like animals, people like things they've seen before. That's why my pick was Finding Dory. Now, full disclosure, I actually had Civil War picked originally because I think Finding Dory is actually going to be the number one movie this summer. I think it is going to beat Civil War. Now, I know that's a dark pick. That's why we jumped down, and I'm still standing by Finding Dory as the number two movie this summer. Now, Finding Nemo is the third highest grossing Pixar movie of all time. Adjusted for inflation, it's the number one. And it's also the number five highest grossing all-time animated film. Now, we all know that summer is big money for sequels. And if your sequel is good and well-reviewed, you're in an even better spot. This movie has had the perfect amount of time to gestate with the population. 13 years have gone by. That means there are people who saw this as a child who are now going to be able to take their children to see it, who've grown up with it their whole lives, whose kids have grown up with Finding Nemo, and they're all going to go together. This is going to be a four-quadrant movie. You know, the summer's really overcrowded with PG-13 genre movies. You got a lot of stuff for young, for boys, for people who love sci-fi action. This is going to reach out to families. Secret Life of Pets is probably going to be okay. It's a little, you know, the Sony Picture Animation, or no, it's Illumination is doing that one. The people behind Minions, you know, they tend to skew a little lower brow. They hit a little more of the poop jokes. You know, Pixar has a little bit bigger ideas, and I'm hoping that, Finding Dory is going to kind of continue that tradition and give us not only more of what we loved in Finding Nemo, but also take the story to new places with new great characters. You know, I feel like Suicide Squad is going to have a really rough time. It looks cool. It's got some really good trailers. It's fighting an uphill battle against the Marvel-DC war that's kind of out there right now. I feel like, as much as we all hate to say it, there are people who will spew venom at that movie. It's got built-in negative as much as it's got a built-in positive. And that's a shame to say, but I do think it's going to affect its box office. Also, there has never been an August release that's been the biggest summer box office winner. Usually it comes from something in May or July. August is usually a ground where you get surprise hits that do better than they're expected, but not things that break the box office and become the number one.
Let me throw this out there real quick. Since, Ash, there's no way in hell your movie is going to beat either of the other two, and you've already got 3 points, why don't we just have Hector and Brian battle it out here for this final spot?
That's
Hector,
fine. If I could just make one point that I agree with what Brian said, that Suicide Squad, because of that August release, it does not have the lead time to make the kind of money that, especially Finding Dory, which comes out like in a couple of weeks, that's going to have so much time to get up there. Anyway, cool. Let them fight. Woo! I'm good.
Hey, good luck.
Y'all are rough. Let me jump in with this. Guardians of the Galaxy came out in 2014, and it was released in August. And it went on to become the third highest grossing movie that year. The third highest grossing movie. A year where another superhero film was released called Captain America the Winter Soldier. And it made more money than that. In 2014, the highest grossing movies were a Transformers movie, which I don't know how those movies make money, but they do worldwide. And then the final Hobbit film, which came out in the winter. So the question was, the second highest grossing movie of the summer, so I'm pretty sure that Suicide Squad has everything going for it. It was greenlit and modeled after the success of Guardians of the Galaxy, which was a surprise hit, but this has everything.
But that's the problem, modeled
after.
The problem is they're too busy modeling after other people and not worried enough about putting out a good product.
Not talking about the quality of the film itself.
It has to come out and perform. It's not just going to come out to a gala opening. It's got to come out and it's got to be good. It's just fighting too much against an uphill battle, whereas Finding Dory's got all the things going for it. It's a sequel to a beloved classic. And just saying it's a sequel, I said that it was the number 5 animated movie of all time. Also, 5 of the top 10 animated movies of all time are sequels. 2 of the Shrek movies, Despicable Me and Minions, and Toy Story 3, all sequels.
Absolutely.
So I'm just saying everything is working for Finding Dory and everything is working against Suicide Squad.
Except, Brian, for that you're mentioning that it was the perfect amount of time to gestate, when I would argue that it's too little too late. It's 13 years is too long of a time for an audience to have fresh in their memory the story of Finding Nemo. It was beloved, and it's still an awesome movie. It's fantastic. But I think that this is a movie that was made for two reasons. Number one, because Ellen DeGeneres willed it into existence, which is awesome. But number two, because Andrew Stanton was recovering from John Carter, from the blowback of that, and went back to Pixar. And even though they don't make a sequel unless they have a fantastic story, we've seen, even the title itself lets us know everything that we need to know about this movie, Finding Dory. We're coming off of, again, Pixar normally has a fantastic track record, but the last Pixar movie in theaters was The Good Dinosaur, which wasn't even The Good Dinosaur, it was just The Okay Dinosaur. It wasn't that great. It didn't make buku bucks. And even though you're going after the kid market in the summer, and I think Finding Dory is going to do very, very well, I think that the number two spot after Captain America Civil War is going to be the superhero film that is a little bit darker. It's a little bit more on edge. It's full of villains. And again, you're saying, well, that's not going to help. It's going to be closer to rated R, even though it's PG-13. Deadpool made the most money, and it wasn't even released in 3D as Suicide Squad is going to be released. So this is something that has absolutely everything going for it. Suicide Squad is the exact movie that people the most are going to go for repeated viewings. Families are going to go see Finding Dory and then get that emotional story and cry and then be done with it. But fanboys and fangirls are going to go see Suicide Squad over and over and over again this summer.
But there's also going to be fangirls and fanboys who turn against Suicide Squad unless it's absolutely perfect. And I can't argue hard enough against the idea that people haven't been watching Finding Nemo and that that isn't stuck with the culture. Anybody who has kids, anybody who was under the age of 10 when it came out or has kids that are under the age of 10 can tell you that Finding Nemo can play on rotation and kids would be so thrilled to see more and see more over and over again. And I don't think that it's Ellen DeGeneres willing it into existence. I think it's the fact that Ellen DeGeneres has maintained her stardom in the 13 years and even gone on to bigger and better things. And now they're I'm not going to take it away. Yeah, they're capitalizing. Why wouldn't you? You can take one of the biggest, most beloved personalities on the planet and put them in your movie, and you're not doing it if she's already a part of your movies. Why wouldn't you make that movie? I just think the thing is going to be a juggernaut. It's going to blow everything else out of the water this summer.
Hector, final thought.
Final thoughts. Finding Dory is going to do great. It's going to do great. But I don't think it has a strong enough idea the same way that Toy Story 3 did when it came out 11 years after Toy Story 2, to have people go and see that movie and make as much money as it did worldwide. I think the Toy Story 3 had the greatest possible pitch. To have their characters age up in real time was fantastic. The sad fact is, if you think about Finding Dory on any sort of realistic level, all of those fish are dead from Finding Nemo. They're all dead. It's a real bummer. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to mention it. So does the movie take place a few months later in 2003?
Oh, maybe.
It's like Land Before Time and Ice Age. All those characters are dead. All of your beloved favorites are extinct. They're done. But
I think out there. Oh my god.
I think Finding Dory is going to do really well, but I really think that this summer and the past few years have shown that the money is going to superhero films. And I think that Suicide Squad, even though it is fighting that uphill battle of fanboys rallying against it for whatever reason, even though I don't think that Marvel-DC, the thing about that Marvel-DC rivalry is that people that want to hate on something are still going to go see it. The fans are still going to go see the thing to be able to talk smack about it. Because that's what you got to do, water cooler talk the Monday after the weekend movie is released. So I think Suicide Squad is going to surprise everybody. It has those Moneyball tracking numbers the same way that Guardians of the Galaxy did back in August of 2014. And I think overall it is going to be Finding Dory. But I still think Finding Dory is going to make a bunch, but yeah.
Brian, any final thought?
Hey, I got really high hopes for Suicide Squad 2. I think all of us want it to be good. I'm not one of those people. I just want a good movie. I don't care who produces it.
All right, and that is the round. Tom, anything you need to
but
say?
I think for this to happen for Suicide Squad, I just feel like there's so many variables that you can't account for, but that are strong for Dory that you can keep an eye on and you can track. And I think it's unfair to say that Dory's going to find it. Just because the name is Finding Dory, that's a sequelized name. The story is going to have derivative elements, I'm sure, but I still feel like Pixar knows how to tell a good story. Even in some of their, in some of their sequels that people consider lesser, I feel like there were some really smart ideas in there, and I feel like they're going to up the ante for what is one of their most beloved classics.
All right. Officially, this is the Hammer of Death. Tom, what do we got?
The biggest point I was hearing was that it was going to be an August release, and I learned a new term. I guess there's periods in the year that movies consider dump months because they straddle different seasons. I think
January.
They could affect
January is a big one, yep.
And the August-September one is also considered one. But like Hector said, Guardians of the Galaxy was the first August release by Marvel Studios, and it took over $94 billion. So, I mean, there's arguments for both. It was a very clean round. A lot of it's speculation, so it's kind of hard to fact check.
A couple people are surprised to not see Independence Day Resurgence on there.
I hope that's going to be good. I don't think it's going to be the number two movie of the summer, right. But I hope it's good.
I'm just letting you know what they're saying on Twitter. Sam said he's more excited about Sausage Party. That's what he's more stoked about. And a lot of people are interested in the Spider-Man costume that seems to be behind Hector.
Well, that's because Hector is
Spider-Man. Is
that
your onesie from the other night?
Yeah, secret's out, man.
That's my onesie from the other night. That's right.
I hate to say that Miles Morales actually is really Hector Navarro, but I think it's the cat's out of the bag.
Donald Glover would argue that.
I wish. It's real cozy.
And I have the poll results whenever you're ready.
Yeah, all right. So, Ash, no offense to you, but if The Secret Life of Pets is the number two movie this year, we have a problem.
Spencer Gilbert predicted that it would be the number two film, and that's kind
of...
Spencer Gilbert
also has March of the Penguins as his favorite movie of all time, so I think it's fair to say that...
I was trying to go with the outside-the-box answer. This has been a weird season where everything is kind of coming in under like what the predictions say.
It's true.
So,
that's true.
You know, I really can't wait to find out who's right. It'll probably be none of us. But
this is tough. This is tough because, like Tom said, we're kind of trying to predict a movie here that we don't know for sure what's really going to happen. Brian said, Ellen, it's a kids movie that we're all familiar with. It's already been tested. It's a Pixar film, and they do have a good track record. Hector brought up the point that Batman is in Suicide Squad, of course, and Batman is a very popular character. People want to see more Batman. I think the 2 points that stood out for me is that Hector said, you know, with Finding Dory, there's only so much you could do with that title. And while, yes, I agree, the kids are going to see this movie, the fact that really remains is fanboys will rewatch Suicide Squad. Whereas kids tend to as a parent of two kids, kids tend to see a movie in the theater and then rewatch the crap out of it once they have it on DVD. But fanboys will go see your movie in the theater multiple times, and I think in the end of the day, that's going to be the factor that makes Suicide Squad number two. So Hector, you are definitely going forward to the lightning round.
I got shut out. I got brutalized.
You win the point. The belt is not on the line, so Brian, you are safe. But well done, everybody. A great 5 rounds. Excellent job.
We have
a
lightning
round.
This is probably... Hear it at the poll?
Oh, yes, please. I would like to hear the poll.
It was actually pretty close. We got... Suicide Squad got 58%, so they agreed with you there, and then 42% for Finding Dory and 0 for Life of Pets.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. I kiboshed that one pretty quick. So
I had those other two movies in my top three, so it's okay.
So Ash, because we do reset the scores when we go into the lightning round, you have a bonus going to this round. One time during the lightning round, at any time, you can steal Hector's choice and make it yours, and Hector has to pick something else. So that is the power that you have. You can only do it once, so use it wisely. You never know when you're going to need it.
Choice.
Tom, are you going to keep time for me here?
Kimber's on top of it.
It's 20 and 10, right?
Yeah, 20 and 10.
Okay.
All right, so just keep an eye out for when Kimber tells you to stop. And our first lightning round, by the way, this is our longest episode ever. Congratulations. Thank you for coming, Hector. All right, ready? Lightning round. Round one. What's the best movie one-liner?
I'll be back.
Okay.
Gonna need a bigger boat.
Okay. Ash, I heard you first.
All right, so I think I'll Be Back is the best movie one-liner because it's quoted in, like, so many other movies, and it's, like, this is, like, one of the best Arnold lines ever. You know, he's, like, the, you know, quintessential 90s action star. It's a fun line to say. You can use it in any genre. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, like a sci-fi film or a horror film.
All right, Hector.
We're going to need a bigger boat is a testament to how good the script is for Jaws, a movie that everything works in that film, and people remember that line, and it perfectly sums up that movie, and it perfectly sums up the characters. Now, it's a horror film with a shark, with an animatronic shark, but it's the characters that people remember and that stay with us, and that perfectly describes how people feel about those characters.
Ash?
No denying that that's an iconic line, but I think that more people have probably heard I'll Be Back from Schwarzenegger, from The Terminator. I think it's a little more memorable.
I'll Be Back is cheesy. and it's overused in various Terminator and other movies, and it perfectly describes how bad action movies can be. It stays with people because of iconography, but it's cheesy.
Time.
All right. This is going to be tough. All right, Brian, help me out here, man. What would you have picked?
Oh, man, I don't know.
It's hard. This one's hard.
Yeah.
All right, Tom and Kimber, do you want to weigh in first?
Well, Hector said that it's a tribute to how well the script is written, that line. If Ashley had said that line had been ad-libbed, I would have given it to Ashley, but because Hector pretty much hammered that one out, so I'd have to give it to Jaws.
All right. Brian, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I mean, I was leaning towards Jaws just because I feel like it's more of a line that can't be confused from anything else, you know what I mean? So I think I was leaning towards Jaws, too.
I was actually on Ash's side the entire time until Hector said one thing, and that is that it's cheesy and overused. And that's the one argument I really wanted to hear, and I did hear it, and I agree. Had you called him out on the fact that is actually an ad-lib line, he would not have gotten the point. So, Hector, you win the first round. Congratulations.
I'll be back first. I thought of that, and then she stole it.
She reused her ability.
No, if I had that ability, I would have used it on Ash. That was tough.
That was a really difficult round. Good job. All right, lightning round number two. Who was the best movie detective? Or who is the best movie detective?
Rorschach.
Wow.
Trying to think. I'm going to go with Joe Friday from Dragnet because that's the only thing I can think of. If there is a Dragnet movie from 1986, I need to fact check that.
That's true.
Then Hector, I heard you first.
Yeah, man, I don't know why I went with this. I've been reading comic books a lot lately, but here's what's great about Rorschach, Walter Kovacs, is in the world of Watchmen, he is uncompromising, and he's the only person to figure out the greatest conspiracy in the history of man, that Ozymandias is going to wipe out sections of humanity to unite everybody, and he's the one that doesn't back down because he thinks that there's something there. He uses fantastic detective work, he goes and he does investigatory work, and it refuses to back down.
Ash, Friday.
All right, so Joe Friday is a product of a earlier time period. He's very much aligned with the setting of the TV show. But now he's in the 80s, and we know the 80s is a totally wild and crazy time with drugs and all sorts of other things. So he's having to deal with being straight-laced in this world and trying to figure out, like, this great conspiracy with a well-loved figure of the priest.
Hector.
Rorschach is based off of the character The Question, who is an old Charleston comic book character, a detective, a film noir throwback who existed in the larger world of superheroes, and that's exactly what Rorschach is. You have to be incredibly good at detective work to be able to get something that a character like Dr. Manhattan can't figure out.
Ashley.
Joe Friday, you know, working in this 80s world, trying to go up against his own police commissioner and, you know, a beloved priest having to solve this crime. And, you know, the whole system is working against him.
This is brutal.
Not enough time, guys.
Wow, yes. Brutal. All right, Tom and Kimber. Kimber, who would you pick?
I don't know, that's so hard, but I feel like Hector dazzled me with so many facts so quickly.
Plus the fact that you got a nod into The Question as a reference to what Rorschach was based upon. The Question is one of the quintessential detectives, so it might be because I don't know anything about Dragnet, and I'm more of a comic book, but I gotta go, Hector.
Brian?
Also, it's a Dragnet comic.
I think based on the arguments, I guess I would probably give it to Hector, although I do think, you know, Friday's more of a traditional detective.
Dan Aykroyd played him.
Dan Aykroyd played him in Dragnet. Played Friday. I am also going to pick Hector. I think the thing that really sells that argument for me is that it's not a character you expect to be the detective, but he does voiceover work through, you know, the Ozymandias storyline and is the reason that you figure it out along with the audience. So I'm going Hector for round two.
Also, just real quick, people are going nuts for Batman. They're like, no one said Batman.
Not in a movie.
I'm amazed.
Not in a movie.
Or Sherlock Holmes.
Never been a detective in the movies.
Exactly, Brian.
I thought Sherlock Holmes for sure.
Yeah,
Sherlock Holmes. So there was a lot. It's when you have to think fast, it's really difficult.
Langley, Sherlock freaking Holmes.
All right, so this one should be interesting. I'm going out of your wheelhouses on round three. What is the best movie about baseball? Don't forget, Ashley, you can steal if you need to.
I know.
The Sandlot.
I'm going to steal Hector's choice.
Damn it!
I knew. That's why I read you. All right, so the Sandlot.
This could be the last time.
Hector, something else. Any movie about baseball.
League of Their Own.
Yeah! We've had this discussion about League of Their Own before, so let's see how it goes. So Sandlot is first. Ash, you have to argue it. Go ahead.
All right, so The Sandlot is the best baseball film because it's like a little nostalgic film about, you know, kids playing America's game and, like, the growth that they have forming this team that are a bunch of misfits. You know, they're all different characters, and the love of the game brings them together. You know, the main character of the movie, he's like a little...
Hector, League of Their Own.
League of Their Own is a fantastic baseball movie, but the reason it's the best baseball movie is because it's way more than that, because it's clearly, still to this day, an iconic film about women equality, about female equality, about feminism. This is a movie that people cite to when they talk about women's issues and the struggles that women have had to go through, because it's an entertaining movie, but it lets you know about all this stuff.
Ashley.
I think The Sandlot is a better film than A League of Their Own because, you know, I think there's a lot more that it had going against them, you know, being a children's film, but something that could be beloved by all audiences, where I think there's a niche market for A League of Their Own where it's not as broad as people would like to think it is.
Hector.
No crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball. It's so good. Gina Davis is so good, and it has a great sister relationship as well that is not usually explored in movies. And also the baseball is all accurate. It's all good. Accurate.
Time.
All right, guys. Brian, who'd you pick?
Oh, we all know I feel strongly on this subject, but I think I'm going to have to go with Ashley on this one.
Okay, why are you picking Ashley?
Yeah, it was just that I think she's right. I think Sandlot has more broad appeal, not just to baseball fans, but also just all people who love family films, and it brings baseball to those people, where there are people who are going to skip on League of Their Own because they're just not interested in the history and the subject matter.
Tom and Kimber?
League of Their Own is one of my favorite movies, and so is Sandlot, so that's a hard decision for me,
As far as the argument went, when Hector said that, you know, the movie isn't just about baseball, it's about other things, I feel like those other things have more of a weigh on the movie, which is good, because that's what makes that movie great. But a movie purely about baseball, I like the Sandlot because, as Ashley said, it's focused around these kids, and all they have is baseball. So I kind of have to lead with Ashley, too.
So that's two votes for Ashley, no votes for Hector. I'm going to tell you, Hector, that I probably would have picked you, and the reason I would have done it is because at the end you made it about baseball, and that's the kind of thing I wanted to hear about from both arguments was I wanted to hear the baseball argument. Why is it the best movie about baseball? But I think in the end, the other two, I'll stick with the ruling here, and I'll give Ash the point for this round. So good job, Ash. You were on the board.
I do want to say that I do think that is the argument between the two best baseball movies. You guys picked the two best.
What about Moneyball?
Field of Dreams is right up there for me.
The
Natural is a great baseball movie. Major League could have an argument. But it didn't make it today, so we're going to go to lightning round four. This was the round I had to fight at Movie Fights panel last night. I fought this against Preston and Steve, which is a local radio show here in Philadelphia. We tied, so we'll see how you guys answer. It's a simple question. Who should play the next James Bond?
Oh. Idris Elba.
I'm gonna say, trying to think of a British person, because it has to be a British person. I'm gonna say Ben Kingsley.
Kingsley. Right.
Interesting.
And we go with Hector first. Idris Elba.
The arguments against Idris Elba that I've heard are that he's too old, which is bullshit. He's fantastic and he's in the prime of his life. And that he is, with trying to sidestep the fact that he's black, that he's too street. And I've heard that from the author of the James Bond novels, and I hardcore disagree because Bond himself comes from the streets. So I think that that's something that you could argue in favor of Idris Elba.
I think that Ben Kingsley could be a good Bond. You know, he is an older actor, but I think that, you know, Bond doesn't have to be like some young up-and-coming person. He can be someone that's older. Plus, Ben Kingsley is a wonderful actor. He's been knighted, and I think it would bring a lot of gravitas to the role. It'd be interesting to see an older actor play that role, and plus, you know, he also has diversity.
Hector.
Idris Elba is one of the best actors working today, alive today, and it would be so important historically if a black man were to play James Bond that that would be huge. That's something that you can't ignore. Gotta mention it. He would be black. It would be nuts.
It would also be important historically for somebody that is also like of Indian heritage to play the role James Bond. You know, Asian actors, which India is in the Asian continent, don't get a lot of love either.
It's true.
All right. Tom and Kimberly.
I know this was a grab for Ashley. I think Ben Kingsley would make an amazing Bond villain. I cannot. The only argument against Idris Elba, as Hector stated, was the age thing. I can get the street thing too, but I think it's high in time. I think we're past that as a culture. I think we can embrace that. As far as the other one, I don't really see him.
Yeah, that was a little out there for me, and she didn't quite convince me on that one, so I have to go Idris Elba, even though I love you, Ashley.
It's cool, Kimber. I love you too.
Brian, who's your pick?
Yeah, that's a hard. I would have liked to have heard Hector say something about how Ben Kingsley is much, much older than Idris Elba. Did I miss that? Like, I would have liked to have seen that brought up as a point. But I guess when you're trying to steer away from the age thing anyway, it doesn't matter. But yeah, I mean, Ben Kingsley was a tough choice, and I think she fought as well as she could have, but I would have given it to Hector.
I too would give it to Hector in this case. I mean, there's no denying that Bond is a street level character. That's the point that really made it for me. I wanted to hear about Bond and how the character could be played, the actor could play the character, and that's when I heard it best. So that means Hector, you are the guest fan friction winner.
I gotta say, Ashley, on that last one, for you pulling Ben Kingsley out of nowhere, you argued him incredibly well. Like, that was so good. And I was starting to think, like, I would like a movie where Bond is older. Like, oh, man.
I'm just so happy to be here. Like, I never thought I would win as many points as I did, especially after my last appearance on the show, having to fight Powerhouse Kimber over there. So I was happy to get 1 point on Hellseeker, which is like, oh, my God. Like, why did I pick this movie? Oh, my God. So I'm just happy to be here, and I think this has been so much fun, guys. So, you know, I hope I can be on again in the future, you know, as a fighter.
Absolutely,
and fact-checker.
Everybody did a great job.
It was awesome. And Twitter is really happy to see me take a fall. I got a lot of challengers now.
They're going to bring it up.
Hyping up with challenges all of a sudden. So everybody like to see a nice chink in the armor there. And, man, Ashley, you were on fire today. I do not want to have to put my title up against you. But now you got two wins. I can't imagine I'm going to be able to avoid it for too long.
I was up so late watching movies last night because, as usual, like, I've never seen half the films y'all choose. I was like, oh, my God, like, my Netflix account, like, none of them are on there except for Brian's and one of mine that I didn't even watch. So it's like, I'm never going to, like, even be prepared. So I felt like I did the least prep but somehow did the best I've ever done. So I don't know.
Everybody did a great job today.
Prepare more often.
So let's talk about a few things real quick. As always, we are Screen Junkies fans here, except for Hector, who is actually a Screen Junkie. But we come together to play this game because we love the Screen Junkies. So please take a moment to look in the description below. You will find all the great information about the Screen Junkies and where you can find them. Please watch their shows. They're fantastic. Hector, in addition to all the other things he does, also does a great show on the Screen Junkies Plus network called Knocking Dead. Hector, can you tell us a little bit also about some of the other things that you're doing right now?
Yeah, like you mentioned earlier, by the way, that was a lovely intro for me, Jack. Thank you so much. I'm hosting a podcast right now for Nickelodeon, which is really cool. I just had a chance to talk to one of the co-creators of the show Rugrats, the classic Nickelodeon show, Arlene Klasky, which was so awesome. That episode came out on Friday, and episodes come out every Friday. They're on iTunes, they're on YouTube, I think they're on SoundCloud, and they're about 30 minutes, and it's just talking to people involved in the animation world in some capacity, including voice actors and stuff. So check that out. It's called the Nickelodeon Animation Podcast. And like you also said, Jack, you can find me and my boys on Superhero News on YouTube, and you can just follow me on Twitter and yell at me for stupid stuff that I say on Twitter and Instagram at Hector is Funny. And thank you guys so much for having me. This was so much fun. You guys are awesome.
Gosh, thank you.
Oh, We're happy to have you here, believe me. So thank you so much for joining
us. That first round started, and I was like, oh, snap. this is the real deal.
Well, these are hardcore fans to your meeting today. We are all the Screen Junkies Elite. We gather every week to watch movie fights and TV fights live. This is the cream of the crop. Speaking of which, if you're a fan of movie fights or TV fights or Screen Junkies in general, we want you to join us here on Fan Friction. You will find our email address listed below in the details. Please, if you'd like to fight with us, we'd love to have you. Next week, we will be introducing two new fan fighters that have never been on the show. So please join us for that. We'll have more details on the Twitter channel as the week progresses. It's Tough Channel, T-U-F-F channel. So if you'd like to follow that, that's where we post our information, or please follow one of us. We talk about it all the time. Tom and Kimber, give us your information. Tell us where we can find OSP.
Well, you can follow OSP, which stands for Odd Shaped Panel. We're a call-in discussion podcast, I guess it would be called. We pretty much get together, talk for a few hours about a topic. This week we're doing Disney, which is tomorrow at 9 p.m., and we edited that down to now we're going 45 minutes because we're getting so much good content with callers and viewers like you. So you can either follow me at I Am Tom Riddler.
Or me at SJ plus Junkie with the IE at the end. Or both of us at Odd Shaped Panel.
Great, and that's a great show. If you've never called in before, it's on Blab. It airs every Monday night at 9, so please check out that show for sure. Brian, you have a new show on our channel as well called the DVD Bunker. Do you want to tell everybody about that real quick?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think our second episode will be going up this week. Filmed right down here where I am right now in the DVD bunker, and where you'll be able to find me clutching my belt for the next couple weeks until I have to say goodbye to it. When I take another, just raked across the coals like I was today. I was like, oh man, what I get for coming in with confidence. I'm going to go home and cry now. But you can find me on Twitter at Herskillies. Hashtag me at DVD Bunker if you want to talk about the show or movies you want to see me do on the show or just movies in general. Come find me. Chat with me.
Fantastic. And Ashley, I know that you don't have any shows currently running yet, but you are in development with your husband, Joe. Please tell us a little bit more about where we can find you.
All right, you can find me on Twitter at Mrs. Davis_DPHS. I love talking about all things movies and geeky things, and I always love showing when I'm actually at school because, you know, we're out for summer, like little media clips in class. So if you ever have, like, a suggestion for something that is school-appropriate for 14- and 15-year-olds, you can always tweet that at me, and I'll figure out the academic connection that we can make for it because you can pretty much use anything and do an academic bent on it because I've shown Honest Trailers in class, I've shown movie fights in class, you know, and it's been really fun, and the kids always get excited. My class in my fifth period thinks that I'm going to run away and marry everybody at Screen Junkies, even though I'm currently married to my husband, because they know how much I love that their content, and it's kind of like a little funny joke that we had going on at the end of the year. So.
And this is the problem we have in America. Our kids don't understand how marriage works.
No, they don't.
You need to be educated.
Yeah, but
you get to pick one, and you got to stick with it, kids. That's how it works.
Yeah, but Vince, what if they're rich, and what if they have a Ferrari? I'm like, I don't care about that.
So everybody... Thank you very much for joining us today's episode. I know we ran really long, but it was fantastic to see everybody. Thank you again for joining us. Stay tuned to this channel for more information, and we will see you all next week. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.